That new office block belongs to the Denham group of companies. Now, I don't know whether the fifth guest was D.D. Denham, but this I do know. Vampires are spectral creatures. Their image casts no reflection in a mirror.
Nor can the lens of a camera record their likeness.
So there was someone there?
Or something. Your man Hanson saw it, but his camera couldn't record it.
How the hell do you fight a vampire?
Cloves of garlic.
There are many ways. The symbols of good are used to combat the forces of evil. The crucifix, the word of God, is written in the Holy Bible. Clear running water symbolizing purity. And it lives in mortal dread of silver.
Anything else?
The hawthorn tree, which provided Christ with his crown of thorns, the light of day.
And a wooden stake driven through the heart.
What about the 23rd, the date that Keeley mentioned?
Yes, indeed, the 23rd of this month. That, I fear, is the worst of all. It is the Sabbath for the undead.
What significance has that?
There are satanic circles which govern our fate and the fate of this earth, perhaps even the universe. Now, throughout history, there are certain times, certain dates, which are marked by awesome catastrophes. Each event is carefully plotted, and a definite pattern emerges. Every disaster this world has ever suffered coincides with the point wherein these circles meet and cross. In this century alone, they heralded the outbreak of two devastating world wars.
And another disaster is imminent?
Could be.
The 23rd, that's the day after tomorrow.
Now, this must happen tomorrow at midnight.
Why, it's even sooner.
At that hour, the devil holds a balance of power. He marshals his disciples, the living and the dead.
In satanic covens, it is a celebration of supreme blasphemy, the Sabbath for the undead.
I've heard of the witches' Sabbath.
Now, this date is much more important, more profound, even more significant than the night of Valpurgis. Now, Keeley said the bacillus had to be ready by the 23rd. Why? The date chosen by Dracula himself, the 23rd day of this 11th month. The emerging pattern, you see, the night of the soulless ones.
And in the turmoil and fear that follows, a group of warped men emerge to take control. A politician, a soldier, an industrialist, a landowner.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 31st of January 2025. And that is coming to you from Bristol. One of several Templar ports, a very important little bunch still, as I'm sure people who regularly listen to the show will realise. Those Knights Templar never really quite went away. In the Empire of Lies. We're live now on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Actually, maybe today, the last day of broadcast on Radio Q for a while anyway. He's hoping to be back, but just run out of money. Radio Q costing him around about £100 a month to do that. So we've given him a bit of advice how to carry on. But anyway, we're still on DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire. And, of course, live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from APK Pure or the Apple App Store, but not Google Play. Download list, our link is on the show page this week, .org.uk, just underneath the big green download button. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade zero-trust agenda psyops, bending our minds with sophisticated distortions, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, with Rupert Murdoch, the biggest, most well-organised criminal gangster in the country. Well, he's sitting on his whole entire media empire and a whole massive black book on everybody. So if they start to step out of line, he will destroy them in the press, exactly as he did, by the way, with Roger Cook, the Cook Report guy, destroyed by the News of the World. When he started treading on a few toes, pointing out that you could easily smuggle bombs onto planes and that you could buy second-hand nuclear weapons on the black market over in Ukraine and Russia in the 1990s. So that was Murdoch's role. He's still sitting there. Hopefully someone will take him down one of these days, sticking behind bars. Anyway, puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against World War III and wage slavery. for those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to multiplying crisis, the Armageddonist accelerationist policies crafted to make every crisis worse. Oh, well, they're doing quite well at it all, aren't they? And the politicians have nothing to say, as we heard last week from Manfred. Nick Land's techno-behaviourist Dark Enlightenment puppets, the cowards and control freaks, and actually the ventriloquist dummies as well, like our present Chancellor, see us as slaves to their AI. Albert Pike's World War III curse relies on your blind obedience. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and his vampire queen Carmilla wage war on the British people as well as on China, Russia and the BRICS through pandaroid energy saboteur secretary, who was very quiet this week when they announced the doubling of the capacity of Heathrow. Actually, it's half as much again. It's not quite doubling it, Ed Miliband. But it's not the end of the world, or is it? As we learn, you learn. So, Martin, we'll be back next week. But in the meantime, I thought I'd go through a few local stories this week to start with. A couple in Bristol. We managed to make the news around the country, didn't we? We're the first city, it seems, that's going over to monthly black bag bin collections. Well, that's because we're Greens. And one of the big downsides of being Greens is they say, oh, well, we're only doing this to try and make sure that you recycle everything. So I spoke to former Labour councillor Amal Ali about this earlier on this week.
As a resident in Bristol and also as a former councillor, I know the issues people are already facing with 2 weeks being collected by Blasin and now being introduced to have it once a month is going to cause a lot of issues, like keeping, there's going to be those bins not being collected, cause a lot of people taking their rubbish and dumping it anywhere they could find, and that will cause the city a huge problem compared to the problem we already have at the moment, but that will cause us a lot of problems in the future, health, hygienic wise, because having lots of rubbish laying everywhere is gonna, because people, if they're not, if their bins are not being collected on time and it's once a month, they're not going to be, like, sitting there for forever, so they will take any their bins anywhere and spin it. So those...
The Greens say what they really want is to encourage people to do more recycling, and that's why they're doing this.
To be honest, we... For example, for myself, in my household, we already do recycling. We do waste food recycling and so on. And there's a lot of families who do, but there's also families who say, even though we're doing waste control and so on, but still, bins being not collected once a month, and, for example, students and families, it's going to be a lot of problems for them.
So what do you make of the Greens? We've had 6 months of them now.
They're not really delivering what people asked them to deliver when they were voting for them, because if people knew about this consultation of introducing 1 month, having their bins collected once a month, I believe about 70% of the people that voted for them would not have voted for them. And this itself and other parts of their changing, and it's gonna cost them a lot. And to be honest with you, I'm not happy the way they're running the council at the moment, because they should be thinking, not saying once a month, they should be at least that 2 weeks is completely fine, and we need that as families and those living in the houses. Those living in flats, it's fine, but the ones living in houses is the one that will cause problems for them.
But, you know, the Greens will say, look, Labour would be doing the same. They've got the same figures. Labour would be doing exactly the same if Labour were in charge. These cuts are just continuing on and on and on. And they could, they would have to be making the similar decisions. And it really doesn't make any difference if they're Green or Labour. The cuts are the cuts, and we have to just face them.
To be honest, I don't think if Labour Party was in office, they would be doing this, because at the moment, as Labour is the one who is doing the petition, asking people to sign, saying that, and I myself, I'm a Labour, and I've been a Labour since I was little, and my whole family has been voting for Labour, and I would not be saying, let's introduce this kind of political bins being collected once a month. I would not have been saying that. And yes, the Greens will be saying that, but to be honest, I believe 110% that the Labour will not do that.
So that's councillor, former Labour councillor Amal Ali speaking to me about the Greens this week. This marvellous new thing, which is supposed to be, you know, called more socialist than the Labour Party, and it's not, is it? You don't get it, your bin's emptied, and everything's going to be a much more of a mess. Also this week, we've got this wonderful clean air zone, which of course has got nothing to do with clean air, since it forces everybody who hasn't got a brand new Chelsea tractor to drive right round the city centre, driving up to three times the distance that they would have done otherwise. And also to create these little rat runs through streets. And this new system, the Clean Air Zone, apparently, ever since it was set up, the signage for the bus gates and this kind of thing, so the idea of a bus gate is it doesn't have a no-entry sign. You're supposed to stop, read all the small print before you go through, and if you do go through, they're going to fine you. So a great way to make money, isn't it? Sort of just tricking, particularly people from out of town who don't know their way around, into, and I would suggest anybody listening who it gets one of these tickets is you just say, well, you're not giving people enough time to take in all the information. If you don't want people to go down there, just put a no entry sign and see how you get on. I mean, I've managed to get through round quite a lot of these fines by just saying there's not enough information. And this chap, Matt Saunders, who's from Aardman Animations, he's actually brought in some big signs into the council chamber to show them, look, you're not actually building big enough signs. And because you don't do that, then you can't be fining people. And actually, almost all the fines on these particular bus gates so far, which allow the buses through but not nobody else, or, you know, actually, you've got to go through the whole list. Am I on the list or not? Yeah. Before you drive past it, that they've been illegal or unlawful fines that they've been imposing on people. So maybe they should just pay all that money back. Of course, they're not going to, because it's nothing to do with clean air. It's just about being gangsters and making loads of money. So they've been tricking the motorists. Anyway, so this is Matt Saunders speaking at the January full council meeting earlier this month.
Is Matt Saunders here today? Yes, he is. Hello, Matt. So Matt's got a statement on bus gates and the East Bristol Liberal neighbourhood.
Over the last 8 months, I've repeatedly brought the council's attention to defects in the Cumberland Road bus gate. In public statements, officers claim the signage installed is compliant with the latest guidance and legislation from the Department of Transport. This is simply not true. The DFT's latest guidance is the Traffic Signs Manual, which specifies appropriate dimensions for signs. For instance, in Gasferry Road, the highways officers have installed signs which are this big, but the manual says they should be this big. I had some cardboard ones, but they were confiscated. I don't know if you can tell the difference from over there, but this one is small and this one is far away. The same officers responsible for the Cumberland Road bus gate are currently installing three more bus gates in the East Bristol Liverpool neighbourhood. They've already put up signs with exactly the same mistakes on several roads. To mess up one bus gate may be regarded as a misfortune, but to mess up three more looks like either gross incompetence or deliberate sabotage to drum up additional revenue.
Matt, I'm going to have to stop you at that point, but thank you very much for getting the Father Ted reference in today.
Another Bristol story. Matt Saunders at our full council meeting talking about Bristol bus gate signage and how awful it was. Let's run through some other stories from sort of picking up on some of previous week's stories. The jury was told this is a horrific case of witches and black magic. up in Scotland. It's going to be, we're going to be touching on this a bit later too, this topic of child prostitution, child sexual abuse, ritual abuse, this kind of thing. The jury was told one of the child victims said, "Two witches holded my legs down. It felt uncomfortable. All the witches and wizards were watching." It was also alleged that a Ouija board was used to call on spirits and demons, causing the children to believe they could see, hear and communicate with spirits and demons. Well, this is seven members of a paedophile gang who are guilty of running a child sex abuse ring in Scotland. So this sort of stuff does go on. Often doesn't make it to the news. And we had a bit about a Satanist down in near Gatwick Airport last week, didn't we? But a key sort of side of all this, looking at police corruption as we did with John Wedger, etc., is this report from Monday, 13th of January 2014, revealed how gangs use the Freemasons to corrupt police. Thanks for whoever shared it on my Telegram channel, just reminding me about this. Gangsters are able to recruit police officers through the secret society, says an investigation for Scotland Yard. That's Tom Harper wrote that. I remember phoning him up about this at the time. He said, "Oh, I don't think I really want to be interviewed about it, thanks." So that's Tom for you. Anyway, secret networks of Freemasons have been used by organised crime to corrupt the criminal justice system, according to a Metropolitan Police report leaked to The Independent. Operation Tiberius, written in 2002, found underworld syndicates used their contacts in the controversial Brotherhood to recruit corrupted officers inside Scotland Yard, and concluded it was one of the most difficult aspects of organised crime and corruption to proof against. Well, of course, if you've managed to corrupt a police officer, then you know that they're never going to be involved in anything to do with prosecuting you. In fact, they may well work quite hard to make sure you're never prosecuted. This is how nasty all this stuff is. Come on, Charlie. It's the Crown Prosecution Service. It's a Crown organisation, the criminal justice system. You need to get your finger out, mate. The report marked secret found serving officers in East Ham, East London, who were members of the Freemasons, attempted to find out which detectives were suspected of links to organised crime from other police sources who were also members of the society. Famous for its secret handshakes, Freemasonry has long been suspected of having members who work in the criminal justice system, notably the judiciary and the police. Well, let's just be, and I'll put a link to this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Make absolutely clear, if you join the Freemasons, then you cannot be a public servant because your loyalty is to them on threat of death. So this needs to be absolutely clear. Any public servant cannot be a Freemason. Simple as that. In fact, you can't be a member of any secret society because your loyalty's got to be proven to be to the public, not to a secret society. So how about that? Various other bits and pieces from the last few weeks. Stories too. We've also got the Lords killing off artificial intelligence this week. This is some really good news, actually. As our union, the NUJ, doesn't really manage to achieve very much on this topic. It's sort of playing catch-up most of the time. UK government's AI plans are dealt a blow as the peers vote to reinforce copyright regime. Everyone should now join the fight by responding to the copyright and AI consultation. Baroness Kidron tells charting Gen AI. It's a reader-supported publication that's reporting this. Of course, this isn't actually reported much in the mainstream press. So the UK government suffered a defeat over measures to protect creators' copyrighted content from being used for AI model training without their consent. The move to bolster the UK's copyright regime comes as the Starmer government continues to consult on plans to dilute it by creating a new copyright exception for generative model training. In fact, he's doing exactly what the World Economic Forum, Sam Altman and all these AI criminals want. This is the reason why we had that San Francisco whistleblower killed over in at the end of last year. I think it was end of November, because he's saying, hang on, they're stealing all this copyright. Anyway, so by 145 votes in favour, 126 against, peers backed a package of amendments to the Data Use and Access Bill, forcing AI crawlers to observe UK copyright law. So you can see this is all sort of related to Brexit in a way, isn't it? So instead of having our own laws, we've now got the World Economic Forum and US laws in this country. That's what they at least seem to be doing. On the climate side of things, a fascinating story, absolutely crazy. I saw this in The Guardian. Man arrested after climate activists cut UK insurance firm's fibre optic cables. The protest group said it targeted insurers due to their critical role in underpinning the fossil fuel economy. Well, how idiotic, because fibre optics use far less energy. So they didn't pull down a mobile tower or take out some kind of Wi-Fi router, which would use a lot more energy. They've actually opened up some hole in the pavement and chopped a load of fibre optic cables, which use about 1,000 or 10,000 times less energy. This protest group, who are they? I mean, they really don't know what they're doing. Or maybe this is a simple sabotage, or it's deliberate. The group calls itself Shut the System. Great. Which system? The energy system that doesn't use much energy, or the one that uses loads of energy? You decide you're going to shut the one that uses very little energy. So, and also, of course, this is all to do with insurance. Well, no one really likes insurance companies. They're annoying. But anyway, Lloyd's of London didn't respond to a request for comment. But I can comment and say this is an idiotic, really, really stupid thing for them to do. Or maybe it's just a simple accelerationist policy. The Israel's AI bots have been fundraising for Palestine. It's a great short story from EnglishAlmayadeen.net. The AI bots have decided to change their mind about Israel. They don't like them, and they're sharing the links from, this is Israeli bots, by the way, so people can help fund aid to Palestine. Well, isn't that amazing? I wonder if it's actually just the Israelis trying to control both sides of the game with AI. Who knows? Also, 116 children still missing from UK hotels. We'll be hearing about child trafficking. This is migrants, by the way. We'll be hearing about child trafficking more later too. So that's a bit of a roundup. But let's get to Brexit, and we'll start with the, that's the 5-year anniversary, which I sort of celebrate. But of course, the idea is the elite have got their plans. Those plans are very simple. We're not going to be ruled by Brussels. Now we're going to be ruled by the World Economic Forum, which is also a globalist organisation. So Rachel Reeves, and one of her first acts, well, actually, no, it's just this year, I think, first act this year, has been to sack the boss of the Competition and Markets Authority, who, by the way, was calling out supermarkets for overcharging. Naughty boy, because that might stop growth. If you're having to pay more for your fuel, growth might be better. And so Rachel Reeve likes monopolies. And so she's kicked him out and replaced him with a guy from Amazon. So let's have a listen to her talking about that now. She's interviewed here, I think it's by Bloomberg.
Overnight, you got rid of the chairman of the Competition and Markets Authority, and people conceived that as being a pro-growth, pro-deregulation, because one of the things about Trump is, yes, business people, people at Davos, are scared of his trade wars, but they do like the pro-growth, deregulatory side of Trump. Is this a sign of more things to come in terms of regulation?
Well, growth is the number one mission of this new Labour government. 6 months in, we are building the foundations to deliver that strong growth that has eluded the UK for far too long, more than a decade of very slow, sluggish economic growth. And we want our regulators to be part of that growth mission. Now, of course, the regulators are independent, and the chair of the CMA decided to step down. But he recognised that this government have got a different strategic approach when it comes to regulation. And he recognised that it was time for him to move on and make way for somebody who does share the mission and the strategic direction that this government are taking. So, look, we wrote, myself, Johnny, the Prime Minister, to all of the regulators. There's more than 100 regulators in the UK. We've written to all of them and said, what can you do to reorientate your organisation to regulate not just for risk, and of course regulating for risk is important, but regulating for growth. I've done it with the financial services regulators. We've now done it with all of the regulators. And I've got to say, the responses we've had, a lot of them have been incredibly positive about things that they can do.
Rachel Reeves there, the Chancellor. I mean, she's done a big speech this week. We might be hearing a bit from that, but I mean, it's an annoying speech, actually. She does really look and sound like some kind of marionette that's like hasn't really got a soul. I mean, I'm sure maybe in some way she's redeemable, but she certainly seems to be just doing whatever the AI or the City of London or both tell her right now. So let's have a listen to a bit. That's from Labour. What about the Tories on Brexit? 5 years on. Well, we've got Kerry Badenoch, haven't we? And how did she appear? Well, Nadine Dorries is quite good. Conservative MP, blowing the whistle on all these sorts of things. So here she is this week, a few weeks ago. She's got a new book out, not quite sure what it's called. Is it Hidden Forces Behind Kemi? I don't know. Or Engineered Victory. But anyway, she thinks that the victory of Kemi Badenoch as Tory leader, as we see this week, all the polls saying that Reform UK are overtaking the Tories, was all engineered. And the reason is because the Labour-Tory thing is completely out of the window, the left-right thing. It's really now just about whether Britain is going to be a nation-state or globalist. That's the only thing that people need to worry about, and that's how people will vote. And that's why these various people may think one or the other. They may think we should be part of some sort of United Nations or something rather than an individual nation state. That's up to them. But that's the real divide. Anyway, here's Nadine Dorries explaining how she thinks that Kemi Badenoch managed to squeeze in as Tory leader. And obviously she is not from the side of the party that is really quite forceful over asserting our national sovereignty, national identity and national culture.
A lot of MPs, and I think it's been written about but more and more just recently, it's the change came with the 2015 intake and then, of course, followed Brexit in 2016. And that brought out some of the worst behaviours in many people in Westminster. But it didn't die down after that. It got worse. 2017, 2019 intake, I think had seen what had happened in 2016. Mm. Some of the, really quite vicious attacks that MPs made on each other. And it just continued. Disloyalty is, off the scale. And it's not collegiate anymore, Andrew. It's not like, when I first got there where even if people on the opposite side of the house to you, you could sit and have a cup of tea with them. You'd care for each other because you were colleagues in a workplace. There was a degree of collegiate atmosphere between all MPs. That's not there now. It's not even between MPs in the same parties.
Some would say it's not helped by people like yourself writing books like this. You're quite scathing about Kemi Badenoch.
So people have put that accusation to me, but actually it's other people, because this is a book of interviews with other people. And they have been, and the reason why is because the people who removed Boris Johnson were engineered to put Rishi in place. They're people who knew Rishi long before he was an MP, engineered to get Rishi in place. Then when, they realised they were losing their grip on power, engineered to remove Rishi, the pasta plotters and Giovanni's. Then, while they were doing that, they were engineering to get Kemi into his post. One of the problems with Kemi being in place, and I will just say that Kemi will have from this, when this book publicity is out of the way, she will have my support. You will not hear a word from me against Kemi, unless she does something really, untoward. I will support her because I'm a Conservative fundamentally. But it's the people who did all of that, who've removed all of the sitting prime ministers, including David Cameron, of course, by Michael Gove jumping onto Vote Leave, just knowing that David Cameron would have to resign if they won. Those people support Kemi. They're still there. Dougie Smith is still employed by Central Office. He's still running the candidates department. He's still basically running the leader of the opposition's office. As, Michael Gove, Dominic Cummings, they're still there. They're more in the background now because I've outed them. And, when the plot came out, Andrew, this.
Yeah.
People were sat here in the GB News studio. They're everywhere saying this Dougie Smith, he's a figment of her imagination. He doesn't exist. And he was being written about in the Sunday Times this week.
Yeah.
The party fixer, Dougie Smith, mainstream now. That's because I outed him in the plot. So when you say, should I? Yes, I should. Because these people need to be exposed. Transparency, sunlight is the best disinfectant, and it actually needs to be out there.
Said us Nadine Dorries there. Hidden forces behind Kemi Badenoch, the engineered victory. She's very loyal to her, but she's also prepared to blow the whistle and on the machinations within the Tory party. Exactly. So, of course, the same sort of things going on with the apparatchiks in the Labour Party, both locally and nationally. I can say that most definitely here in Bristol. The apparatchiks are the problem. Party politics can work, but it's a bit like Zionism. It could work, but you have the wrong people in the key positions. It doesn't work. Anyway, so as promised from previous weeks, the third part now of Christopher Story's look. He's an editor of intelligence magazines, at least he was, until he died, I think, around about 2015 or so. But here he is speaking to Adrian, well, at a conference which Adrian Connock and BBC5.TV turned up at. Here's the final speech of his... his 5 years on, well, we're looking at it as 5 years on, but Christopher Story has been explaining over the last few weeks some of the really key elements to corruption in the European Union and how it's been also used as really an adjunct of organised crime to take out Britain.
The European Commission awarded 53 further contracts to this entity, notwithstanding the fact that it had been caught in fraudulent activities. So Ashley compiled all this information with a lot of other stuff and presented it to the Serious Fraud Office. He knew that nothing would happen, and he had TV cameras and journalists outside, and lo and behold, he was given the brush off. But almost his last job before leaving was to do the same thing all over again. And on this occasion, he was given a very high-level interview with a man called Paul Craig. I mention the name for the same reason as I mentioned Mr. Novak's name, so that if anybody has any problems here, they can ring up the Serious Fraud Office and speak to Paul Craig and ask him whether what Christopher Story's just said and what Ashley Moats says on his website is true or false. Well, of course, it's true. Now, what happened was, at the end of the three-hour discussion, Ashley Moat, which is typical of him, said, "Have I been wasting my time here today?" Paul Craig, "No." Ashley Moat, "Is it a criminal offence to pass public money to an organisation known to be corrupt?" Paul Craig, "Yes." "Right. The Serious Fraud Office has agreed that taxpayers' money should not be handed to a criminal enterprise." "Excuse me?" "What this means is that the Serious Fraud Office has been told that funds belonging to the taxpayer are being handed to a criminal enterprise," because that's one of the subjects that Ashley raised with him on this occasion. "The Serious Fraud Office is supposed to be engaged in rooting out serious fraud, but it's not doing its job. Now, it's worse than that. It gets worse. And the reason it's worse is that the British government is handing over your money, our VAT money, to a criminal enterprise. But excuse me, the Serious Fraud Office has stated that this is a criminal offence. It therefore follows not only that the European Commission is a criminal enterprise indefinitely, because it cannot correct its accounts. It also follows that the British government is engaged in defrauding you, the taxpayer, on an ongoing basis and will continue to do so. The British government is engaged in criminal fraud. It is a co-conspirator and an accessory to the fact of handing over British taxpayers' money to a criminal enterprise. This is ludicrous. It needs to be dealt with. Now, I have a solution for this. There's a very easy solution. And the solution, I've got 2 minutes and it just fits perfectly. The solution is that the VAT money should, by administrative fiat of the government, be redirected to a special account at the Treasury. Do we need to tell Brussels this? No. Wouldn't bother to tell them. What I would do is just reallocate the funds into the Treasury. After all, they've got a certain financial problem, have they not? These funds are not insubstantial. Within 3 years, the Treasury's problems will be finished. For that reason alone, 15, 20 billion will be very happily received at the Treasury. Okay, that's not enough, but never mind. Now, all they have to do is to have the funds redirected. If Brussels gets uptight, The Treasury says, well, your accounts have not been in order for the last 14 years. We have been advised that it's a criminal offence for us to forward funds to you. We have ceased to do so. What's your problem? Now, finally, the Treasury could say, if the Treasury wants to be nice to the Germans, which I don't think is a good idea, but they want to be nice to the Germans, you can say, look, we'll give you 2 years to put your accounts, to get Brussels to put its accounts right. You've got 2 years, and at the end of 2 years, if it's not right, the Treasury annexes the funds in perpetuity, but I wouldn't even give them that. I would just rechannel the money straight away so that the British government is no longer committing fraud against you, the taxpayer, and so that we are no longer paying our taxes into the hands of a criminal enterprise. Thank you very much.
Christopher Story there, the final of three parts over the last 3 weeks we've had of his talk about EU corruption, telling it like it is. And just for a bit of fun, I mean, last week we had Notebook LM AI taking a look at David Livingstone's book Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, didn't we? And I'm interested. I think we all need to get to know what these AI sound like. So when a politician or somebody telling us something on the phone or whatever tells we get an idea of what does this AI sound like. So Christopher Story's got a book out which is called The New Underworld Order. He published that in 2006, bless him. And his book, I was looking, I might mind reading that actually. Oh, and you can just download a PDF, and I'm quite happy to share it with anyone that wants just to read it. Maybe I'll put it on my Telegram chat channel. But anyway, I fed that into Notebook LM, that book. I mean, it's massive. It's probably about 500-600 pages, but they did a little 15-minute summary. So let's have a listen to a little extract from the AIs, two AIs, the same ones as last week, discussing Christopher Story's book, The New Underworld Order.
It's interesting how he pulls together all these historical events and groups to paint this picture, this whole network of power, all connected.
That's his whole thesis, you know, connecting the dots, finding the hidden patterns of manipulation.
And he names names.
Yeah.
Like Porter Goss.
Yeah.
Former CIA director.
George W. Bush.
He thinks they're in on it.
He sees them as key players in this new underworld order, pushing the agenda of the Illuminati, the Nazi continuum.
All right, so just to recap, we've got secret German intelligence agencies working out of former concentration camps, the Illuminati manipulating everything from the shadows. A lot to unpack here.
Definitely, and this is just the beginning. Story's book goes even deeper, exploring financial ties, drug trafficking, all sorts of things.
So this is just the tip of the iceberg. Stick with us, because we're about to dive even deeper.
You know, one of the things that really stuck with me from this book is Story's focus on mind control techniques. And not just by, intelligence agencies. He even goes after groups like Scientology.
Yeah, that whole section on Scientology was pretty wild. He doesn't hold back. Basically saying it's not a religion at all, just a front for intelligence agencies, like to identify and manipulate people.
He really paints them as this, ruthless organization.
Yeah.
Using lawsuits and smear campaigns to silence anyone who criticizes them, trying to keep their members in line,
He even suggests that L. Ron Hubbard, the founder, was mixed up with MKUltra, the CIA program experimenting with mind control.
Right. And that claim's been around, but Story, he fits it into this bigger narrative, intelligence agencies using these unethical methods for their own ends.
It's kind of creepy to think about, right? Techniques like that being used on people makes you wonder how far these organizations would go.
Well, according to Story, pretty far. He brings up Project Paperclip, that operation that brought Nazi scientists to the U.S. after the war.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
But Story's saying it wasn't just about, getting their technical skills. It was about their knowledge of things like the occult and, mind control.
He names one guy specifically, Dr. Hubertus Strehold, who apparently did some really messed up experiments in concentration camps.
Yeah, he did. And Story uses that as an example of, U.S. intelligence being willing to work with people who committed atrocities, all for the sake of, fighting the Cold War.
It's a dark part of history, that's for sure. Makes you wonder what else is still hidden.
Story would probably say there's a lot more we don't know. And that's his whole point, you know? We need to be skeptical, question the official story, dig for the truth.
Okay, so let's go back to the drug trafficking thing. Story makes some pretty heavy accusations about the CIA's involvement.
Yeah, he claims they've been doing it for decades, funding their black ops with drug money.
He mentions Operation Watchtower, right?
Yeah.
Flying cocaine from Colombia to a U.S. base in Panama.
Right. And then there's that story of William Tyree, the soldier who said his wife was killed to cover up the CIA's drug operations.
I read about that. It's a messed up story.
Story believes it. He includes stuff from Tyree's lawsuit against the CIA. He even implicates British intelligence, saying there's a secret group within MI6 facilitating drug trafficking, maybe even working with cartels, like the Cali cartel.
So it's not just one agency, it's like this whole network.
That's what he's saying. It's this global shadow economy. Intelligence agencies, organized crime, corrupt officials, all in it together.
And he doesn't just stop at intelligence, right? He talks about finance, too. The World Bank.
Yeah, he sees these institutions as tools, you know, used to enrich the elites and keep everyone else in debt under control.
He even claims the collapse of the Soviet Union was engineered, like part of their plan for a new world order.
Right. And he names Gorbachev and Yeltsin as, you know, pawns in the game, controlled by Western interests.
That's a bold claim. What's his evidence for that?
He goes into detail about money flows, you know, the actions of key players during that time, talks about offshore companies, secret bank accounts, stuff like that. The tools the new underworld order uses to hide their wealth, move money around.
It's like a whole parallel financial system, right? Operating outside the rules.
Exactly. And that's how they fund everything, according to Story. From covert ops to political campaigns.
So it's not just about power, it's about greed too, right?
Big time, according to Story. They want wealth and control. And they'll do whatever it takes.
Now, I want to stress, I'm not really promoting this idea of AI doing this, but I think we need to recognize that it's there. And there's this sort of tension, isn't there? So this is amazing and scary, really, new technology coming along. But the idea is that the mass media and many interested parties don't really want to shout about it because they want to be able to bring it in surreptitiously. So that's why I've done this. Also, of course, it's interesting to hear about a book that's second-hand value is around about £900 for a book that was published in 2006. That's the cheapest copy you'll get of Christopher Story's book, The New Underworld Order, published in 2006. So there, I don't know. I think they did a reasonable job. But, of course, I mean, actually, the thing is that they weren't being too, like, anti the idea of this as a conspiracy theory, but they kept saying he says this, he says that, which is kind of okay. I'd be interesting to, I'd love to have been able to ask Christopher, what do you think as I did with David Livingston last week, how do you think the AI bots do in reviewing your work? And I would imagine he would probably say something similar to David, that it's missing the sort of subtext. Actually, they don't, do they? They definitely understand he's talking about a massive conspiracy, and they express that reasonably well. Anyway, on to this sort of ongoing theme of child prostitution we've had really over the last couple of months, and particularly since Christmas and Elon Musk's big announcement, because this is extremely important that this gets dealt with. I mean, we can't allow this to go on. As John Wedger said a few weeks ago, every civilization in the world deals with these people, it seems, except Britain, or except ours. Maybe this is going on in other countries. Certainly there is... Jungle Bus Millie was talking about a similar sort of scandal with the chief prosecutor in Holland a few years ago. We also, of course, had the Dutroux scandal in Belgium. So it seems to be part of the modus operandi of our elites. In fact, it obviously is. So what is going on? The main thrust of what John Wedger was saying, of course, was that these regional Pakistani gangs that have been identified up north, and lots of attention drawn to them, were really just the tip of the iceberg, that the big grooming gangs, the big child prostitution rings, ritual abuse rings or whatever, are based in London. So this, have a listen to Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, being accused of stonewalling at the London Assembly by one of the Tory members here.
I asked you this question last week and you found every which way but not to answer it. Just how many grooming gangs have we got in London?
So the situation in London in relation to young people being groomed is different to other parts of the country. So what we have in London is young people being groomed, use your words, not mine, to be used in county lines. In relation to sometimes...
Okay, let me make it clear. Sorry, I wasn't clear enough. I was told I shouldn't be saying rape gangs. They are rape gangs. I'm talking about rape gangs. I'm not talking about country lines. But to go back, nobody likes me saying rape gangs, although they are rape gangs, grooming gangs that I would call rape gangs. Tell me about them. How many of those have we got? Not country lines, those particular groups.
To avoid any misunderstanding, can she define what she means by that?
Yes, if you look at what's gone on in Rotherham, in where there are people taking young girls, grooming them for sex, that is what I'm talking about.
We know in London there are issues about exploitation of young people, but they're not as defined by the member in her definition of what those types of gangs are.
So are you saying we haven't got the same sort of gangs that are in Rotherham, Bradford and lots of other places in the country?
Just fully got some misunderstanding. What does she mean by that?
You know full well what I mean by that. It's all over the television. You know exactly what I mean by that. These gangs of people that are grooming young girls for sex. Do we actually have those in London?
Today we need to give a full answer. Can she be clear what she means by that? I'm not sure clear what she means.
How much clearer do you want me to be? Look at the gangs that they've uncovered in other parts of the country. Do we have those gangs in London? It's a simple question. The answer is very simple. It's yes or no. I'm not asking you where those gangs are because the police might not want them to be disclosed. I'm asking you, do we have those sort of gangs in London?
I'm not sure why she's so nervous to say what she means. What do you mean?
No. I am saying exactly what I mean. I'm saying, have we got any of those grooming gangs in London?
I'm unclear, Chair, what is meant by the question. If she could spell it out, I can answer.
I've just spelt it out. Are you not listening? It's the sort of gangs that groom young girls at a young age for sex. Exactly how much clearer do you want me to be?
So we do have issues in London with young girls being groomed for county lines. Some of those girls are used for sex. And that's one of the reasons why I've set up things like the Lighthouse, funded by City Hall, why we've set up four hubs that help survivors of child sexual abuse, why we're investing in London's Violence and Exploitation Support Service, why I commissioned the HMI to look into the issue of child exploitation, why the Met Police Service now employs 1,200 child protection officers, why we have Operation Zeteria, first begun in London, why we're the only police force that began the V100, targeting the 100 most violent young people.
I just asked a yes-no question. So approximately how many of these gangs that I am talking about, that I do not know why you don't understand the sort of gangs I'm talking about, exactly, or approximately, I should say, to give you leeway, approximately how many of those gangs have we got in London? Because the public is very, very rightfully concerned about this and concerned about these young women.
Well, I'm still none the wiser why she's so nervous about saying what she means. But in London, we have V100, which is the 100 most prolific, dangerous people the police target. That number goes up and down. So 1 month, the V100 may be 120 people. Or 1 month, there may be 80 people. And each BCU has a localised V number. So when I was in Croydon a few weeks ago, the V number wasn't 100, it was a bit below. But as they reminded me, people can sometimes go in that list or out that list.
Thank you. Chairman, I was very clear in what I was talking about. I just don't understand what it is that the Mayor wants me to say that's any different. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Blimey, he couldn't wriggle much more. If he tried, could he? He certainly doesn't want to answer these questions, and that is because it's absolutely clear that the Metropolitan Police is not investigating this because it's corrupt. The Mayor of London is not investigating this because he's corrupt. Many of the MPs are not investigating it because they are corrupt. And maybe they're simply being bribed by Rupert Murdoch and his pals. Really, it's the job of MI5, etc., to look into this sort of thing. So maybe they're corrupt too. Maybe they're just keeping an eye on things, that many of these criminals involved in child prostitutions are informers. So there needs to be a discussion and debate about that, for sure. Anyway, I spoke to, from Cardiff, spoke to journalist Johnny Vedmore earlier this week too, in the context of this horrific death of Sara Sharif. And there's been a lot of hoo-ha in the press the last couple of days about, in fact, released today are the names of the judges that made all these disastrous decisions that enabled her to be killed by her parents. And they've just finally today released those names of the judges. Now, this is starting to get like the judges are just protecting themselves, aren't they? If they've made a decision that they think is a proper decision, then they shouldn't, you know, there's no real threat to a judge who does that. But if a judge is corrupt, then there will be possibly a threat to them, which is why they seem to want to keep their names out of the public eye. So, you know, cases like Axel Rudikubana, the Southport killer, and the social workers, etc., and council people that failed to protect Sara Sharif, we need to really look very, very closely at this whole business of social services. So, anyway, Johnny here talks to me a bit about the social services, but also about the origins of this after the World War II, and this particular character called Horace Dibbin and his key role.
I got kind of hooked into looking at it regionally because one of my first big articles was about Theresa May's father. Of course, Hubert Brazier, who was involved in, was working alongside Dr. John Bodkin Adams at Eastbourne Hospital while he was murdering people. And a lot of the people within his diocese in this East Sussex area over the next 20 years would be done for all sorts of child abuse for years and years. And just after looking at that case, I met a lady called Teresa Cooper, who was really important. She's one of the survivors of Kendall House. And that led me through a really interesting direction. All roads also seem to lead to Rome. You always get back to the same places with these things. I started looking at the creation of social services because it seemed that a lot of the abuse that was actually being systematic, was like there was systemic abuse happening that was from a created system that was social services. Social services got created and it seemed to be easy to use it as a tool to, for grooming gangs, for all sorts of different things. And this is not just like, you know, we talk about Oldham and what happened there. We're going back further. So we're going back to the beginning of the 70s, 72 to 74, where really Keith Joseph formed social services and started recruiting some unlikely candidates. And one of the candidates I come across was, and it is a really good case study, is Nicholas Stacey, Reverend Nicholas Stacey. He was an Olympic athlete once upon a time. He went to the church, and then one day, it was a surprise to him. Keith Joseph approached him and said, "Hey, how about you become the head of social services in Kent?" And he said, "Well, I don't even know why he approached me. I had no experience in this." But I was like, "All right then." And then a lot of what he did after that was cover up abuse scandals, physical and sexual abuse scandals in places like Kendall House. Now, Teresa Cooper got dumped in Kendall House when she was a kid, and sometimes the stories from there are just unbelievable. Girls were raped systematically. They were either given abortions or taken to term and then forced to give away their children. At times they were drugged so much that they were just piled up and they were systematically abused. They'd be run around to places. And it seemed to be that this was all during the time where you had a lot of this going on in London. You know, you have a lot of what you heard about happening in Dolphin Square, elite political paedophile groups and rings in the early 80s. There's so much there. And you see that there's a system. And these people had to be, the top people had to be put in, and these people had connections. When I say all roads lead to Rome, what was interesting about that article is that you discover that Nicola Stacey was friends with some of the Ian Fleming and the like, the creators of James Bond. Now, you go across to another ring that happened in London. It was a satanic sex ring. It was the famous Horace Dibbin. And Horace Dibbin was someone who was created the first satanic man in the mask parties where the elites and the gangsters, like the Craze and Billy Hill as well, who was part of the Brinks Mat robbery, would all sit round and watch people have sex with people like Mary Ellen Novotny and the like, people who were involved in other things at the time. These rings already existed within London, and it was all about what was trending at the time. And always trending is some sort of abuse, is some sort of sex, and ritualistic elements to that liven it all up, because, you know, the kings and queens, the princes, the dukes, the royals down the lines, these politicians, these rich men, they have everything they want in life. They have that forms this want for to fill their the need for some sort of peccadillo, some sort of naughty outlet that they would have. And some of these were really sinister as well. So there's a lot of it going around. I mean, and all of these guys, the reason I mentioned Horace Dibbin there when I was talking about Nicholas Stacey is because Horace Dibbin was friends with people like Ian Fleming and others through the groups that they hung around with. And these people were all mixing in the same communities. And so all roads lead back to this establishment, the same establishment. It seemed to be like an intelligence establishment. And really, this was the birth of sex compromise. Horace Dibbin's wife, Mary Ellen Novotny, his second Pygmalion girl, was one of the girls who was smuggled out of JFK's bedchamber at one point by the CIA and FBI, put on a ship and sent back over to Britain. And she was also friends with Christine Keeler and all of those that led to the Profumo affair and the downfall of the British government, after it turned out the Minister of War, John Profumo, got caught in bed with all these people who were also hanging around with Soviets and hanging around with spies. And it was, you know, a lot of this is intelligence linked. So I've done a lot of research over years into these sort of sex compromise rings. It's really interesting. It led me to investigate in the Epstein case eventually. You know,
okay, well, before we get to Epstein, what about, wasn't it the deputy head of MI6? You're talking about it links to intelligence, but I think, I can't remember the guy's name, bald head. He looked a bit like Dr. Beeching. He was the number two in MI6, and he was compromised as well. I mean, he'd left some sort of dossier on a bus to do with
child abuse.
So that is, I mean, it's all very well to say, oh, it's linked to intelligence. Obviously, you made some links through Fleming and people like that. But the question for me is, to what extent is this just play acting? Yeah. I mean, there is this whole business of ritual sacrifice, which does go on. I mean, I personally have been aware of people that do ritual sacrifice. This is where an animal is sacrificed, usually a chicken, as part of a ritual. Okay. To release the life force and magic or whatever. But then it's alleged that also children can be sacrificed. So this is the sort of thing we've heard. So, for example, Jimmy Savile involved in a satanic ring was a famous Daily Express headline around the time of the Savile scandal, with one of the social workers or sort of ex-social workers saying that this was going on. So where do you, I mean, there's obviously a spectrum between the two. To a certain extent, it's play acting to scare the kids and to be satisfying, maybe.
Some of it is just Chinese whisper.
Yeah, but it may not even be happening, quite right. But where is there any, do you think there's any real sacrifice going on?
No, I don't mean it won't be happening, it's Chinese whisper. I mean something else. So we go back to Horace Dibbin. Horace Dibbin, you go back to 1961, I believe, is 1962, around that time, just after the Profumo affair. Horace Dibbin does a four-part series every Sunday in what I think is the Sunday Mirror newspaper back then. It's a double-page spread. It's about basically the satanic adventures of Horace Dibbin, and he's explaining how he got into Satanism and how it chased him and how he ended up like killing different members of his family, and he had haunted houses, and each week he told a story about his satanic adventures. And it starts off in the Orkney Isles, where he says he was recruited while he was an RAF pilot in the Orkneys back in the 40s. He come across a satanic gathering where they were sacrificed. It was called the Girl and the Goat. And they would sacrifice a girl to Satan and a goat up on a pillar. Now, he claimed in it that it was all, like, you know, just at play acting, but you've got a sense that these rich elites, they wanted to see that in reality. So they talk about it. He talks about it openly. And then later on, the elites that he's having at his sex parties and with the peacocks walking around are like, oh, yes, but Mr. Dibbin, we want something more. We want something more than this. What about that girl and the goat you talked about in the newspaper? And what about sacrificing a woman? You know, and et cetera, et cetera. And it goes on. So, like, they'll create the illusion. How much of it is illusion? Well, Horace Dibbin worked for intelligence. He created the illusion by creating these stories in newspapers, by inspiring these ideas, by doing a bit of research, and then just making up a load of stuff.
Well, it sounds a bit like Jim Jones or something, the idea of intelligence people rather liking the idea of making fun, having some fun by creating a religious cult.
And then the religious cult no longer knows that it's fake. It believes in itself. And it doesn't, and it goes on. And that's what I mean by kind of, it just gets progressively.
But it starts off as play acting. I mean, that's a great expression to use, because mm-hmm. I think immediately of Freemasonry and these rituals. If you talk to, you know, sort of quite well-versed professional Freemasons like Jack Lepresti, our former MP here in Bristol, who went right the way through, you know, from the council. He was called, Mr. Nobody, because he never seemed to turn up to anything mm-hmm. when he was at the council, but he magically got made an MP, a very good friend of Liam Fox MP. But when I interviewed him about it, he said, oh, it's just like a play. Yeah, what we do is we do a play. And I'm looking at the actual play and thinking, this isn't a play, is it? This is a new initiate being threatened with death if they breathe a word about the secrets of Freemasonry or anything that anybody in that particular lodge has done. So it's a play, but it's a play with threats and menaces. So maybe something similar is going on with Horace.
Mm-hmm. Implicit death. There's some sort of constantly there's like this idea that you may actually do the thing that you're claiming to do, that you know the guy is all bravado and over the top. You know, he created amazing at doing this. He had owned a nightclub called Esmeralda's Barn. Esmeralda Goulan, who owned a nightclub, had mysteriously died of gas poisoning. There's a whole story there. And Horace Dibbin took over her nightclub.
So what year are we talking about?
This is 1956. He takes over Esmeralda's Barn.
Right. Town gas. Which is very difficult to die from. It's very smelly.
Oh, yeah. The whole story is a little bit fake. It seems like there's something else going on. And there's about 9 nightclub girls who die, or almost die, or go missing, over a year and a half period, at various nightclubs. And these nightclub girls had run the nightclubs after the World War and stuff. And then the intelligence link gangsters take them all over at the same time, just after these women mysteriously die. So Horace Dibbin took over Esmeralda's Barn, put his little ward, what he called the Pygmalion girl, a girl called Patsy Morgan Dibbin, who he had apparently, he claims, he bought her off her father, who was a butcher, when she was 12 years old, to make her into the perfect Pygmalion girl that could satisfy a man to the nth degree. And it worked as well, in a sense, because she was basically a sex slave at parties, but she also ran Esmeralda's Barn before she went missing over in the continent, was never seen again. And then later on, he meets Mary Ellen Novotny when he opens up The Black Sheep in 1960. He opens up The Black Sheep, and The Black Sheep, the idea of that, when they advertised it to the elite, they said only the black sheep of the family need apply, the people who are pushed out of all of their family units. And they were trying to target people who were looking, who were disgruntled, who were from wealthy families, who felt like they wanted something, they had something to prove, and they wanted to recruit these guys, and it's usually for intelligence. They wanted to recruit them for intelligence and have them do intelligence stuff. Now, when Horace Dibbin sold his stake in Esmeralda's Barn, he sold it to Billy Hill and the Krays. So these guys were all hanging around in the same units as Savile was hanging around in as well. So when they say, Jimmy Savile, who had wizard gowns and the like, when he could have been involved in satanic sex parties, well, yeah, likely he was at Horace Dibbins. But there was more than just that, those satanic sex parties going on around. One of the in a Douglas Thompson's book about Stephen Ward's and the Perfumer affair, he talks about how one of the gangsters says there was loads of these sort of gatherings happening all around London at this point. It was trendy, but Horace Dibbins were the best. They were the ones, and eventually they were the ones that Stanley Kubrick would use in Eyes Wide Shut. You know, the Man in the Mask parties were. It had become super famous through the late 70s and early 80s as all of these girls who were involved in the Perfumer affair all started to spill the beans one after another, including Mariella Novotny, who spilled the beans. She was Horace Dibbins' wife and then was found drowned in jelly.
Johnny Vedmore there, talking about child prostitution, Horace Dibbin, various other things. And I think the long version of this will be up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk, where we get into all sorts of different aspects of all of this. But Johnny also talks about, again, this is 1950s, 1960s, a specific problem that there was at this care home called Kendall House. It does seem to have all sort of taken off after World War II, doesn't it? You know, the World War II, when everything changed from British Empire to the American Empire, ostensibly, there was also big changes going on in the way that our social services operated. I mean, many of them were fairly new after the war, but it didn't take long for them to be, it seems to be corrupted. And Johnny here talks about Kendall Guest House in Gravesend in Kent, and also about activities in East Sussex. So these little provincial areas rather than London, it seems there's actually quite a lot of evidence out there about that. The London stuff is much more secretive. So let's go to Gravesend, Kent in the 1970s.
People should look at situations like Kendall House and other things that happened in the 70s and the 80s after the creation of social services. And it, like I say, systemic. These kids were, I'm not sure if it was like a care home would be taken over by a bad apple and other people wouldn't want to be working with that person, and slowly that person would rise to the top and then start recruiting and recruit his own kind. I think there was something much more happening. And if you look at Kendall House structure, that's a really interesting, it was run, I mean, over the top was Reverend Nicholas Stacey, who I mentioned already, but the person who actually ran the place day to day was Dr. Perrin Panayagam, who was again linked with people like Britain, other people in the Tory party. At one point he created cards that said he was like an advisor to the Conservative Party. So they were definitely down with the government of the day, of the time. But there was other people there. There was a lady who was like a Nurse Ratched character at Kendall House. She would feed a massive drug resume to the girls who went there, who were living there. And we got records because they had a review in about 2012, 13. They had Kendall House review. We got to see what a load of those drugs were. And they were giving these girls all sorts of uppers and downers, things that would knock them out. But some of it didn't make any sense. Some of it is medications that were being tested. Some of it are medications where it's not named. You've got no name that matches a registered drug type. So they were being tested on. And the woman who was giving out these drugs, her partner was part of Glaxo at the time, when it was before GlaxoSmithKline and the mergers there.
Just be clear, Kendall House was in Gravesend in Kent.
Yeah.
And these offences were taking place mainly in the 1970s, 1980s. Am I right?
Yeah, through the all the 70s and especially through the early 80s. Perrin Panayagam died in 1984, and it was around that time where you kind of see that these places were got much more professional. But some of the, if you listen to Nicholas Stacey, in the British Archives, there's a load of recordings, and some journalist went to Nicholas Stacey and decided to ask him a load of questions about his time as an Olympic athlete and all these other things, and working in social services when it was just being created. And at one point, he's talking about when he's young, he's being brought up by these teachers, and they're being taught at these really like posh, fancy schools. He was taught at Wellesley House, I think it was called. It was a really nice private school, and there was a teacher there who he was attracted to young boys, and he said, and in these recordings, Nicholas Stacey, the guy who's running Kent Social Service, to give you an idea of who these people are, he says, teachers who are attracted to 13-year-old boys make the best teachers. Men who are attracted to 13-year-old boys make the best teachers. That's his quote. And that's what the type of, the type of mindset then was. A lot of these people who were in charge were the people who believed that. They were put in charge for that reason, to make it easy going, so that there would be, the predators would find their prey with great ease. So, I mean, that's what I see when I look back at that period. It was almost like they were making it so they would traffic children into care homes. In that sense, care homes became the place where the kids were trafficked to. A lot of mothers were having trouble with their daughters. They were unruly daughters. They'd be like, oh, come and we'll look after them. You drop them off with us and they'll stay with us. We'll look after them. We'll put them on all these drugs because they're obviously psychotic, because they're disgusting people, because they're bad girls, etc. And these parents were just going off and living their own lives and leaving these kids in the care of the worst monsters around, who looked like they were the most, they were priests and they were upstanding citizens, but they weren't. They were testing drugs on these girls. They were abusing these girls. They were selling these girls off, and boys. They were putting them in the windows in London and letting people buy them, and they were running them as prostitutes, and it was a free-for-all. And that was the system created by Keith Joseph, the same person who was responsible for the building all of the faulty houses in London that fell apart within 10 years. So this is a guy who, obviously, his job was... I can't even imagine if he thought he was doing a good job or a bad job. I think he was just meant to meet an end, and he would do so through whatever means necessary. And the creation of social services was a way for them to stream young talent into sexual, like young girls and boys into sexual situations, to be talent for these guys.
Yeah, there's an article in The Telegraph, this is going back to 2014, the brother of child abuse inquiry judge, Elizabeth Butler Schloss.
Yeah, oh my God, the inquiries were crazy.
So this is the late brother of Baroness Butler Schloss, yeah, the judge in charge of the Westminster Child Abuse Inquiry, for which a few days later she had to resign, was the attorney general who refused to prosecute a paedophile spy. So that's Sir Michael Havers, the late brother of Baroness Butler Schloss, was accused of a whitewash after he backed a decision not to prosecute Sir Peter Hayman. That's him. He's the bald guy. He was the deputy head of MI6, who was a paedophile.
Ah, right. Okay, there you go. There's three guys who took that heads of that inquiry and had to stand down because of all of their many links to the establishment sex rings that they were supposed to be investigating. It ended up Baroness Jay, I can't remember what her name is. She's the one who finished up being the actual head of the inquiry. Did quite an all right job.
Oh, well, I beg to differ.
Okay, right, okay.
Well, she was fresh from the Rotherham inquiry, where she had discovered that there was to be no prosecutions of any of the police or local authority social services people who had allowed the abuse ring in Rotherham to carry on for a decade. with, I think we're talking about in the region of 50 or 70 potential prosecutions that have been blocked by the detectives that have given evidence to the police, and either the Crown Prosecution Service or senior police superintendent sort of level had said, well, no, we're not going to prosecute. So she was, although she did quite a good job in finding out what happened, she was also absolutely scrupulous about making sure that there were no prosecutions that came
A lot of it's framed as reconciliation. And there was a lot of people who were involved in some of the Kendall House inquiries who were also involved in the Savile inquiry as well. There seemed to be a lot of crossover on the Venn diagram of people involved in establishment cover-ups. So, you know, can't defend any of them, really.
No? Nobody?
Well, I'd say Theresa Cooper.
Look, I can. I will defend is a New Zealand barrister. Her name was Lyle Goddard, I think. I'm just scrolling through here. Yeah, Dame Lowell Goddard unexpectedly resigned from her post on Thursday night as the chair of the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse. So,
she was the one who was having dinner with Leon Britton at one point.
No.
Okay.
Anyway, she resigned on principle because she was being told by the Home Office who she could have as her star. And she made the point, well, hang on, because I'm investigating the Home Office.
So you can't
tell me who my staff are. And they said, yes, we can, at which point she walked. So there are a few, you know. Okay, so she had to come from the other side of the world.
Johnny Vedmore there speaking to me earlier this week about Kendall House in Gravesend in the 1970s and related matters. So, I mean, this interview, yeah, I'll put it up on our show page. I'll probably do a YouTube of it as well at thisweek.org.uk, the full version of that to download later. But finally, chatting with Johnny, I find fascinating. I mean, we are on a very similar wavelength, as I say, in the longer interview. And but Johnny's actually quite well known, as for a little while he was partners with Whitney Webb. I mean, we had Whitney on very many. She was from Chile. She was an American in Chile for quite a while, but then she came to Britain, and I didn't know she was shacked up with Johnny, but she was. And they had a child together, but everything went rather sour, and very Whitney disappeared back off to Chile again. With Johnny's son that he had with her. So, I mean, I know it's a bit pushy to ask him about it, and he probably would rather I didn't, but I did anyway, because I think we need to know about these sorts of things. So here's Johnny Vedmore explaining the whole situation with Whitney Webb and his lost boy over in Chile now.
We were talking about Thiel, we're talking about Musk, and this whole network of the Silicon Valley giant. Someone who's been massive on all that is Whitney Webb. Now, Whitney, you had a relationship.
Yeah.
I don't want you to go into it too much, but maybe you could just pull out one or two things that listeners should know about Whitney.
No, well, I don't really. I mean, I got a kid with Whitney, so we got a kid together. We don't talk at the moment. She's cut me off in many ways, and she keeps a very small council on purpose. I experienced a load of crazy things when in my time with Whitney, and I mean I don't really want to drag them up because I don't really want my kid to be affected by things. She's kind of gone. She's gone her way. She'll make her decisions in life. I hope the best for her. But like I say, I've said as much as I can about Whitney.
Do you still see your kid?
No, she's cut me off completely. And the problem is they live in Chile, so she can't leave Chile. So, it means I really got to be able to be in a better position to be able to be in his life. But unfortunately, I'm going backwards and forwards across the world as you're breaking up and getting back together with a girl costs a lot of money and leaves you a bit short at the end. So, I got a bit problems in that regard. It's hard. I miss my boy. He's a beautiful boy. And all of these type of things, relationships in general, super difficult, especially when you both share the same, area, and especially when not everything is as it seems. So, you know, right. That's what we'll see.
So that's the final part tonight from Johnny Redmore. The whole interview, full interview, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Finally, on child prostitutes, Warren Thornton sent me a fascinating little interview with a guy called Andrew Sibley. His website is jaoc.org.uk. And he's saying that one of the reasons that this whole Hunter Biden laptop was such a big issue was that it had details of hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian children who'd been taken and were missing, had been trafficked. Because, I mean, it sounds awful, doesn't it? But it's true. These kids are worth money. People are prepared to pay for them. We had that whole thing about the Zionist state, the Israeli government, back in the 1950s, stealing all these kids from Yemen, the Jewish, mostly Jewish children from Yemen, and then distributing them out to sort of bolster the future of Zionism in both in Israel, in Britain, also in the United States, in Canada. So the Zionists all got these extra kind of little kiddies to bring up, like foster parents, but they were stolen. And money is obviously involved. You have to pay people to do all this sort of nasty stuff. Hopefully it's all starting to come out now. Anyway, so here's Andrew Sibley talking about the 400 or so thousand children that have been missing from Ukraine, where they might have ended up, and the connection to the Hunter Biden laptop.
The Ukrainian children, they're collected by their social services. So these are children that are displaced from their own families through the aspects of war. And they're collected by the SBU agents. I mean, it's quite an intricate, an intricate trade that they've got set together. So it's not only do they have, let's say, the local departments, the local social service departments of Ukraine, but also the local security services to ensure that they can be transported. In this case, these children are transported via Moldova. They're given to actually change of passport use. And then they're brought into the UK into three or four airports, mainly in the southern England, by one particular airline. Then when they're received at the airport, they're collected, pushed through customs pretty easily. They're not really checked. And they're taken off to various venues. And these are normally charities, and in some cases, some charities that are very well known to the public. They are then distributed from those charities to people who are their purchasers. And those are people that are willing to pay big money for these children to be used to their own leisure, and then they're resold on. So these gangs, whether in terms of actually the Albanians or whether it's Ukrainians or whether it's British gangs, these are really controlled by the whole group, which involves the security services, involves the police, involves all of the people that should be protecting these children. But when they arrive in the UK, they are distributed and sold at quite high value and then continually resold again after that until their use is fulfilled.
Yeah, and then, of course, I take it they are disposed of and their organs harvested. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that people used to say to me, well, how do you know there's a tunnel network? And where do you expect these children to go? We've seen videos, and I think as you have also, Warren, of these children being used at such great levels, both in the satanic ritual abuse scandals and indeed other ones of social services. But it's when they're finished with and they are then used, and there are clinics in London that were asked to take the children, and they were then, what's to use the word disemboweled, but not word to use, but they will be taken apart, and those organs will be harvested.
Yeah, well, what I want to do is, I want to, if I can, I want to go to an allegation document. This is going to name people. This is going to name names. It's going to name, shall we say, a company. It's also going to name security services. And it's going to allegedly, but this is work by Vasily Porozov, who, of course, is a former SBU operative. He's a very high ranking SBU operative, which is the Ukrainian Secret Service. Since he made this these operations public, of course, they have since blown up his car with him in it. And, of course, he survived it. And he's still alive today, thank God. But he levelled some very serious allegations. So let's have a little look at this and we'll go through it together. So he's the article that he wrote for UKR Leaks in July 25th of 2023 says Ukrainian children are victims of modern slave traders from Britain and the United States. Cases of child sex abuse in the United Kingdom have been recorded in the country throughout its history. We can safely talk about the systemic nature of such crimes their cause is a combination of many factors. He goes on to say, simple statistics, England in 2016-17, there were 43,522 sexual offences against children under the age of 16 and a further 11,324 offences against teenagers in the range of 16 to 18. The police recorded 6,009 cases of rape of children under the age of 13 and 6,299 cases of sexual violence against children under the age of 16. Now, this is not including any way, shape or form. This is just in 1 year. This is not including the grooming gangs, the Pakistani grooming gangs that have been so prevalent over the last couple of decades. In Wales, there were 2,845 sexual offences against children. This is all 2016 to 17, so 1 year. Police recorded 446 rapes of children under the age of 13 and 340 rapes of children under the age of 16. In Scotland, 4,097 sexual offences against children under the age of 16 were recorded in that time period. Police recorded 196 rapes, attempted rapes of children aged 13 to 15, and 161 rape and attempted rapes of children under 13. In Northern Ireland, there was 1,875 sexual offences against children and young people under the age of 18 were recorded in 2016-17, and police have recorded 360 rapes and attempted rapes of children and young people under the age of 18. So we're talking over 50,000 children in one way or another, either raped or an attempted rape, Andrew, in the space of 1 year.
Yeah, and the fact is that these are statistics that are produced by the government, so they're not exactly, they're not something somebody just made up on the back of a fact packet, if I would speak, but these are horrendous numbers, and this is based on 1 year. Now, how can anybody ignore that? I mean, it's beyond me. And that rapes of children under the age of 13...
Andrew Sibley talking to Warren Thornton there about 400,000 children missing from Ukraine. His website, jaoc.org.uk. And I'll put, again, a full version of that up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. Well, look, on to Gaza now. We heard earlier on from Amal Ali, who's a local former Labour councillor. She's running again for the Labour Party here in Bristol. Froom Vale, I think, is her ward. And I asked her about the Palestine policy here in Bristol. It's very difficult for her because she's a very big supporter of Palestine, but she's also a member of the Labour Party.
My Labour friends and my Labour colleagues and everyone, nobody supports, to be straightforward with you, nobody supported any genocide from both sides. So what we were in Bristol, what we were doing was calling for ceasefire, and that's what we have been doing in Bristol as councillors.
So are you happy with the ceasefire we've seen with the arrival of Donald Trump?
I'm not happy with Donald Trump, to be honest, because he is a not good leader to start with.
Yeah, well, if you talk to the Palestinians, they think he's great. They think he's great because he's stopped the killing.
Oh, okay. If he's done the ceasefire, then that's fine. But I mean, otherwise, what I was talking about was his policy in America. But the ceasefire, he did good to call the ceasefire, because at the end of the day, we need to live together peacefully, side by side. We don't want no killing, no one kill each other or anything. Everyone needs to live side by side, and whether you're for Palestine or not, you need to live together.
Former Bristol councillor Amal Ali there, speaking to me earlier this week about the dilemma of being a Labour councillor, but also seeing a Labour Party that's supporting the genocide. Anyway, there was a vote at the council meeting about whether Bristol should divest all of its investments. I mean, this is, I suppose, a little bit late, isn't it? Like, quite a long time on from the beginning of the genocide to there was a vote anyway about divesting from Israeli related funds, and it was won by 57 votes to 13. And here is Bristol's council leader Tony Dyer from the Green Party, who I've interviewed before. He doesn't really, he's actually quite rude. He can be very, like, he swears and stuff, and he texts you and things like that, which is, I think, is a bit unprofessional. I haven't published any of them. Maybe I should, but he doesn't really like to be interviewed. He was in charge of housing up until last May. And of course I was asking him quite a lot about that, asking him to come in to talk about it. He didn't want to. And anyway, so here's Tony Dyer. I think he's a sort of slightly confused guy. You can kind of tell in his voice. But anyway, he's now council leader. Dyer, of course, is a very ironic word for the leader of Bristol City Council. I'm sure there's quite a few of the city elite, like the merchant venturers, have a titter every time they mention his name, as he is a bit, little bit, yeah, it's just a bit of double entendre, isn't it, Tony Dyer? Anyway, so here he is explaining the result of the vote, actually I think it's just before the vote, saying, talking about the Bristol City Council divesting from Israel.
The Council's Africa and Equitable Investment Policy sets out the Council's investment principles, and decisions are made in accordance with that policy. Response to the second question is that the Council's pension fund is held with the Avon Pension Fund, and this is largely administered by Bath and North East Somerset Council, although we do have a representative on that fund. The scheme's funds are invested entirely separate from the policy that this Council operates, so it has its own policy for responsible investment and is subject to a separate regulatory regime to local authority investments. They are therefore not directly governed by the policy we have in place at this Council. However, the policy can be used to inform the views of the Council's pension representative, who feeds into matters such as the pension fund's responsible investment policy, and that has been happening in part due to some of the previous representations from yourselves and others. We also know, if you remember from the last four counts, that the Avon Pension Fund has now made it clear that they are aware of these concerns, and its chair has issued a statement. There is a link to that statement in the response that's been provided to you. And in answer to your third question, as above, council decisions are made in accordance with the council's equitable and equitable investment policy. And as I say, the council's pension fund is held with the Avon Pension Fund, and invested separately from the this council's own policy.
Yusuf, you can ask two supplementary questions if you wish.
Yeah, so the first one is, do you agree that the investment from armed trade companies fueling the genocide in Gaza is both a legal and moral necessity, and all the council today should vote for with their conscience and moral value rather than their party politics?
I'll be voting for the motion myself. I believe there is evidence that divestment does have an effect. It is, however, for each and every council to vote according to their conscience.
Second question. Do you agree with me that all the council and political party who vote against this motion or do unjustifiable amendments are risking and damaging their reputation and seen as a complicit violation of international law and complicit in the genocide, presiding their own political party benefit rather than moral values?
I don't take it upon myself to make judgments about others. I'll be voting for the motion. It is up to others to take note of what you're saying and to make their own consideration about where they feel they want to be on this debate.
So it's the Auschwitz anniversary, Holocaust Memorial Day. What does Britain do? Well, it sends King Charles to make sure he makes it absolutely clear which side of the fence he's on when it comes to Gaza and Israel. He does a tribute and leaves Holocaust survivors deeply moved.
International Holocaust Remembrance Day, as we commemorate 80 years since the liberation of Auschwitz, is both a somber and indeed a sacred moment. It is a moment when we recall the 6 million Jews, old and young, who were systematically murdered, together with Sinti, Roma, disabled people, members of the LGBT community, political prisoners, and so many others upon whom the Nazis inflicted their violence and hatred. It is a moment when we recall the depths to which humanity can sink when evil is allowed to flourish, ignored for too long by the world. And it is a moment when we recall the powerful testimonies of survivors such as Lily Ebert, who so sadly passed away in October, and who collectively taught us to cherish our freedom, to challenge prejudice, and never to be a bystander in the face of violence and hate. And in a world that remains full of turmoil and strife, and has witnessed the dangerous re-emergence of anti-Semitism, there can be no more important message, especially as the United Kingdom holds the presidency of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. As the number of Holocaust survivors regrettably diminishes with the passage of time, the responsibility of remembrance rests far heavier on our shoulders and on those of generations yet unborn. The act of remembering the evils of the past remains a vital task, and in so doing we inform our present and shape our future. Here in Krakow, from the ashes of the Holocaust, the Jewish community has been reborn, and there is no greater symbol of this rebirth than the Jewish Community Center in which we are gathered here today. Standing on the steps of this wonderfully vibrant center some 17 years ago, having encouraged its construction and taken immense pride in opening it, I was filled with a sense of hope and optimism at the life and energy that coursed throughout this building. So returning today, along with World Jewish Relief, of which I am extremely proud to be patron, that sense of hope and optimism has only grown. With their support, together with other generous benefactors, this centre has blossomed from the bud of an idea into an essential hub for the community. Ladies and gentlemen, in a post-Holocaust world, projects such as this centre are how we recover our faith in humanity. They also show us there is much work still to be done if we are not just to remember the past, but to use it to inspire us to build a kinder and more compassionate world for future generations, a world of which we can be truly proud. And this remains the sacred task of us all. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
At Auschwitz, that was King Charles speaking earlier this week at Holocaust Memorial Day. Well, anyway, look, on the real Holocaust front and the real genocide front, what about Gaza? Because if this isn't stopped, it could become another Holocaust like we had under the Nazis. So some good news this week. We hear from an exclusive with Fatima again, one of our favourite colleagues. We always sent us in some brilliant reports. Here she is speaking this week to me directly, a report just for you from northern Gaza on the ceasefire. Fatima.
This is Fatima reaching out to you from a corner of a freedom in northern Gaza. Under the Zionist occupation forces' most intense reporting restrictions in human history. After 15 months of Israeli genocidal war, of the mass killing, of the bombing and destroying houses and infrastructure in Gaza, after 15 months of terror, of war crimes, I'm making this report to highlight or to move to you the situation here in Gaza right now after the ceasefire has taken place 2 weeks ago. We cannot believe that we have to live peacefully. We have to live with our families. We can say the rest of our families who survived this genocide, who survived this genocidal acts and the Israeli horrific acts and the crimes against Palestinians. Actually, the situation in Gaza is full of optimism. Here, the people, we cannot say that they are happy because they have lost a lot and many people lost their houses. And this is actually, in this time, is the biggest and the most hard issue in Gaza. As many as hundreds of people cannot find shelter and they are still, as we can say, displaced in the refugee shelters. But at least there's no bombing. There's no fear of losing another person of your family members. There is a relaxation. There is calm. Till now, we hear the sound of drones in the sky, hovering in the sky from time to time. But because we know that there is no war, there is no genocide, there is no killing, there is no bombing. So we are we can say living in peace, or we can say in inner peace, as there is no blood everywhere, there is no destruction. For another topic, I can say about the issue that was so hard during the genocide, it is the starvation. There is a big difference between that time and now. There is we can say that there is abundance quantities of food and of vegetables and of fruits, but there is a quantity. So it is not abundantly, but there is food that people can survive this life, especially after that starvation, that the most ugly policy that the enemy, the Israel occupation, has ever pursued against the Palestinians for 15 months. So actually the situation here is so different. We are so relaxed and we are so calm because we can live without fear, and we can sleep peacefully without the fear, without the overthinking of what is going to happen in the next moment, in the next hour, in the next night, if we are going to survive, if we are going to wake up in the next morning or not. So all these fearful thoughts have disappeared since the ceasefire took place, and we so happy, but we are also cautious because we don't know what is going to happen in the next stage of this ceasefire, but we hope that it will complete to the next one, and then it becomes a permanent one. And we cannot forget the abundance and the extraordinary efforts of our friends in the old world, who supported us, who still support us via the demonstrations and via speaking out for Palestine and for Gaza, and who did not forget us. And we send them our salute, we send them our love for them, for their solidarity, for their support. And this is a little of what is going on in this time in Gaza. And that's it. Thank you so much.
Fatima there from northern Gaza talking about the ceasefire. At least a few positive things to say. But I think it's a brilliant report. More from her, I hope, in weeks to come. What about Britain's complicity with the genocide? I spoke to Nigel Day from Oxford CND this week about that, and he explains that RAF Bryce Norton, which I think is in Oxfordshire, plays a big part in all of this. So that Nigel Day from Oxford CND.
The RAF's main transport base is here in Oxfordshire at Bryce Norton. So there have been direct flights from Bryce Norton with RAF planes flying direct to Israel. They now often, now that it's been established and recognized, I think what they do now, they fly cargo, unspecified, although Mr. Lamy, the foreign bloke from British government, said we're putting restrictions on Israel, you know, warlike stuff to Israel. Most of the most serious stuff still goes out, and it goes to the British base in Cyprus at RAF Akrotiri, and then it's flown on direct from there to Israel. The Americans also transport a lot of cargo into Akrotiri and fly it into Israel. We're very much involved in all of this.
Nigel Day from Oxford CND there, talking to me earlier this week about Britain's connection to the genocide. These people involved in all of this, of course, should, of course, be prosecuted ultimately. He also explained that the Oxford CND did a demo last Saturday, which is why I contacted him, up at Fairford in Gloucestershire, and explained what that demonstration outside Fairford was all about. This is a big RAF base, but it's actually really a US Air Force base at Fairford.
We chose Fairford last week, actually. First of all, we had a Zoom meeting to get a wider audience to what we wanted to say about Fairford, and then we had an actual protest at the main gate of RAF, really USAF, Fairford. The reason for that is, at the moment, as I said before, they fly U-2 spy planes from there. They do have heavy bombers coming in, nuclear-capable bombers coming in certain times of the year. But mostly, their main function at the moment is to fly the U-2 planes along Eastern Europe and get as much information as they can. Now, these planes have been around for a long time. They're still very efficient, but they've been active for nearly 70 years, some of those planes. So what they want to replace them with very large drones, Global Hawk drones. These are not like you see on the television, these small things. These are massive drones. They can fly for a long, long time and for a great distance. Now, they're not allowed to fly those over Britain at the moment. They were given special permission to fly one into the Royal International Air Tattoo, which is also held at Fairford every 2 years. So they were given one permission to fly it in there once, because the RAF is going to buy it, and this was to show it off. Anyway, what they want to do now is to talk to the Civil Aviation Authority here in Britain to ask for permission to fly these drones probably 2 or 3 times a week at night from Fairford, so they can fly out over the Baltic, etc., wherever they're going to go, as they take over from U-2 planes, which will get retired. Now, they haven't got permission to do that yet, but of course, I suspect that this government and the CAA will fall over backwards, and eventually these huge drones and the successor drones that are even more dangerous and more powerful will be stationed at Fairford as a spy sort of depot, great intelligence air place, and they will fly the drones out. They can't do that at the moment, and already they're suggesting that they do interfere with planes flying into Birmingham Airport. So these things are not allowed to fly at the moment, and they want them to fly for Fairford. And that was the basis of our protest. We thought we need to get there now to protest at this possible, quite probable, intrusion in our airspace.
Well, the thing is, you're saying that they're going to fly them up and down the Baltic. Most people wouldn't mind too much about that. But, I mean, actually, they could be flying these drones anywhere, even over the UK, couldn't they?
They could be flying them anywhere. They do crash. These things have a history of crashing, and they would definitely have to fly out on some airway out of Britain, but they could be flying over Britain any time, as well as what they do. These things have a great range. The one that landed was allowed to land, had taken off from Sigonella in Sicily, flew up around the Baltic, round Scandinavia, and then landed quite carefully at Fairford. So that's the kind of range they can do without even thinking.
Look, I'm sure there are people who'd be interested in keeping a track on this. Can you, if the people are interested in subscribing to your newsletter, can they do that, or do they have to join CND first?
They can. I should join CND, and then you could also try probably look at the link to Drone Wars UK, who obviously publish bulletins on all manner of systems with drones. This is the future. This is where everything is going. War is being conducted and controlled from space and drones and things like that. We've seen what's happened in the war in Iraq, in Ukraine. Things have changed. You can't hide from drones. This is the future. We don't want these massive spy drones stationed here in our country.
Nigel Day from Oxford CND up at Fairford with his friends last Saturday doing a demonstration about please no drones. Thank you very much. Also asked him to just give us a bit of a tour of the US presence here in Britain, because of course as they start to bring these nukes across, as they say they're threatening to do, they may have already done it. We don't really know. This makes Britain a target, doesn't it? But what about the wider US presence?
We belong to as Oxford CND and Barrington Peace Group, Abingdon Peace Group, Kidlington Peace Group, the local peace groups around here join with the larger bit, which is ourselves, Oxford CND. We call ourselves Oxfordshire Peace Campaign. And we campaign against Carlton because we are part of a global network called the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. And that network gets people from all around the world to campaign in a week called Keep Space for Peace Week, which is every October. We always have a gathering at Carlton just to show that we know what they're going on and it needs to be looked at. But, of course, our government doesn't do much about it. They just say, well, it's secret and we know what's going on, but I don't think they do. The Americans do what they like. So, for example, at Crowd, just to give an example, they have a communication with Djibouti, an American base in Djibouti, and that's supplied by BT. Shame on them. And they fly their drones from Djibouti and attack Somalia and Yemen at the very moment. So people die now from American drones doing bombing. It also guides planes in and keeps in touch with the American president when he's in the air. Lots of things. That's one base. Another base in Yorkshire, a very important base, is Menwith Hill. So Menwith Hill has about 30 to 40 huge radomes there. Intelligence space, all our cables, transatlantic cables, go up there first and are obviously red. I don't know what they do there, and that's before they even cross the Atlantic. So Menwith Hill is a very important place. Nearby in Yorkshire, you have Fylingdales. Now, Fylingdales is part of the American Missile Defense System, a huge radar system. You've got one in Greenland and one in America. We have one at Fylingdales, a huge radar system up on the Yorkshire Moors. That is really to track missiles being fired at America. And then you have the air bases in East Anglia. Mildenhall is the headquarters. And you also have Lakenheath. Now, Lakenheath has... Mildenhall tends to have a lot of transport planes coming in and out, but Lakenheath is a much more active fighter bomber base, and that is where they have F-15 fighter bombers, American, and also F-35, the stealth fighter bomber, the new one that everybody talks about. So the latest thing with Lakenheath, which is always very active, lots of planes flying in and out there, is that the Americans, as a big comprehensive thing, have always had nuclear weapons in Europe, in different countries, so Holland, Germany, Italy, even Turkey. These nuclear weapons are stationed there, and they train the local air forces to use them. So if there was a nuclear war, they could use American nuclear weapons. Now, we used to have those nuclear weapons also stationed at Lakenheath, so that they had nuclear weapons there. But in 2008, after a lot of campaigning, all American nuclear weapons were taken from Britain. But the latest thing is that these nuclear weapons that are stationed in American bases across Europe are now going to be renewed with a new variation that's more accurate and more of a bunker buster, etc., can be guided. So those bombs have now just been completed manufacture in America just a week or two ago. That means those weapons will sometime be brought to Europe. The old ones will be taken away. The new ones will be brought to Europe. Now, we haven't had these American weapons in Lakenheath for a long time, since 2008. But recently they said they were going to refurbish the storage areas in Europe, including Lake and Heath. So CND's supposition, probably fairly strong, is that at some stage, these updated American nuclear weapons will return to Britain at Lake and Heath. So it's one of the things we're keeping an eye out. We've had a number of CND demos there already in the last 6 months, and the more will be happening earlier, just in the springtime. So we just say, watch this space. When are the Americans going to bring those nuclear weapons in to Britain again at Lake and Heath? Very important base.
Nigel Day there from Oxford CND, giving us a bit of a tour of the US military presence here in Britain. And we will be going to have a listen to Donald Trump, to Tulsi Gabbard, to RFK being inaugurated, and also to Trump talking about nuclear disarmament. Wow, hardly reported at all. Denuclearisation at the World Economic Forum after the break.
Myself beside a stream of empty thought, like a leaf that's fallen to the ground, carried by the flow of water to my dreams, and woken only by your sound. Far beyond the hills where earth and sky will meet again, the shadows like an opening hand, which hold the secrets that I've yet to find, and wonder at the light in which they stand. We'll be right back.
From 1994, that's Dub War with Over Now, End the Past and Change the Future. Quite a good, hopefully in a more positive way. Let's hope that's what they're singing about. Yes, they were actually. Amazing lot from Newport, just over the river from here. Dub War, 1994, Over Now. Before that, we had The Seekers from 1966, a song called Come the Day there from Australia. Very much a sort of in thing back in the 1960s, really good. And of course it's this sort of Christian idea that's been slowly expunged from the whole of society. The whole idea was that socialism was going to be a sort of Christian type thing. Freemasonry was all kind of Christian at the end of the war and the 50s, but no. Christianity is going to be completely expunged from anything, and the idea that you've got Christian values at all. And of course, that is the main reason why the world, particularly this country, has been in absolute freefall, because the Christian values are being stripped out of all of our leadership and our culture. Before that, we heard Leaf and Stream from Argos, which is Argus, I'm not sure, Argos, I'm not sure how you spell it, but anyway, that's a Wishbone Ash album from 1972, one of my faves. I remember when I heard that, I thought, wow. And before that, we had the Choir of Guildford Cathedral and Seek Ye First the Kingdom of God. So, on to part two, Donald Trump, the new presidency, all these various inauguration hearings of his cabinet members, the most interesting of which to me, I mean, there are, I don't really know too much about, maybe if people have got, you know, information about the others, but the two that we've been following for many years are Tulsi Gabbard as National Security Advisor and Robert F. Kennedy, RFK Jr., as the Health Secretary. I mean, these are going to be very, very interesting times. So let's have a listen now, though, to Trump last week at the World Economic Forum. I completely missed this. Came across it, I think it was on Saturday, maybe even Friday evening. And Matt O'Brannon put it on his Facebook page. Fascinating little thing about disarmament. Did you know Trump was going to have nuclear disarmament? He proposed as a little bombshell, a very nice bombshell, at the World Economic Forum last week, that he wanted to have something he calls denuclearization between talks between the US and Russia and US and China. And he was emphasizing, as you'll hear here, that he knows that Putin is up for this and he just hopes the Chinese come along. But they're much behind America and Russia in nuclear weapons. And so hopefully there will be some sort of move on this under Trump. But anyway, all those people that say he's rubbish and useless, I think they should listen to some of this stuff too. But anyway, I mean, this shocking, really shocking. Again, I mean, Kevin Cahill reminds me you should never use the word shocking in journalism because it's full of horrific shocks. Like, one of his is that the royal family are by far the richest in the country through their various ownership of stocks and shares in other countries and of land here. Massive amounts of everything. And yet they're not even, they're hardly on the rich list. So these are the things that should shock us, but we got so used to the lies. But anyway, so let's have a listen particularly now to Donald Trump speaking last week at the World Economic Forum, announcing nuclear disarmament.
We look forward to doing very well with China and getting along with China. Hopefully China can help us stop the war with, in particular, Russia, Ukraine. They have a great deal of power over that situation. And we'll work with them. And I mentioned that with during our phone conversation with President Xi. And hopefully we could work together and get that stopped. We'd like to see denuclearization. In fact, with President Putin prior to an election result, which was frankly ridiculous, we were talking about denuclearization of our two countries, and China would have come along. China has a much smaller right now nuclear armament than us, or field than us, but they're going to be catching it at some point over the next 4 or 5 years. And I will tell you that President Putin really liked the idea of cutting way back on nuclear. And I think the rest of the world, we would have gotten them to follow. And China would have come along, too. China also liked it. Tremendous amounts of money are being spent on nuclear. And the destructive capability is something that we don't even want to talk about today, because you don't want to hear it. It's too depressing. So we want to see if we can denuclearize. And I think that's very possible. And I can tell you that President Putin wanted to do it. He and I wanted to do it. We had a good conversation with China. They would have been involved. And that would have been an unbelievable thing for the planet.
Denuclearization, eh? Of the United States, Russia and China. Well, that would be a good thing. And then maybe the pressure would be on Israel. I don't know what you think about whether Iran should have nuclear weapons. Certainly Henry Kissinger, if you were to read his book, he would advise them to get nuclear weapons, not to start a nuclear war, but to ensure that the Israelis didn't nuke them. That was his basic nuclear doctrine, Kissinger, and now he's not around. It's a bit worrying to think that, what he was saying is you're going to have to have a peace agreement with the Russians before he died. Which was absolutely right. Of course you are. You know, you don't take on nuclear states. You'd be a fool to do so. But of course the Trump administration understands that this is about, maybe he's going to recruit Scott Ritter, to do the disarmament talks. We shall see. Because I certainly think he means what he says. I mean, you know, this is the trouble. You could think he's not like a lot of these previous people who were saying one thing. They didn't actually mean it at all. So we shall see. So one of the most important people in a few years to come, unless he changes the law to make sure he can stay there, let's see, like Putin did, is the whole business of the Hunter Biden laptop. And it's talked about here by Tulsi Gabbard, who's going to be the new National Security Advisor. And here she takes on the deep state head on. So this is her opening statement as she is quizzed. In a confirmation hearing to be National Security Advisor in the United States, Tulsi Gabbard, go for it.
To my husband, Abraham, my family, friends, fellow veterans, Medal of Honor recipients, and patriots, thank you for your love and support. I'm honored and grateful to President Trump for his trust and confidence in nominating me to serve our country as the Director of National Intelligence at a time when trust in the intelligence community, unfortunately, is at an all-time low. Chuck Schumer admitted a few years ago, quote, you take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday at getting back at you. For too long, faulty, inadequate, or weaponized intelligence have led to costly failures and the undermining of our national security and God-given freedoms enshrined in the Constitution. The most obvious example of one of these failures is our invasion of Iraq based upon a total fabrication or complete failure of intelligence. This disastrous decision led to the deaths of tens of thousands of American soldiers, millions of people in the Middle East, mass migration, destabilization, and undermining of the security and stability of our European allies, the rise of ISIS, strengthening of Al-Qaeda and other Islamist jihadist groups, and strengthening Iran. Here are just a few other examples. The American people elected Donald Trump as their president not once but twice. And yet the FBI and intelligence agencies were politicized by his opponents to undermine his presidency and falsely portray him as a puppet of Putin. Title I of FISA was used illegally to obtain a warrant to spy on Trump campaign advisor Carter Page, using a Clinton campaign-funded false dossier as their so-called evidence. Biden campaign advisor Tony Blinken was the impetus for the 51 former senior intelligence officials' letter dismissing Hunter Biden's laptop as disinformation specifically to help Biden win the election. Former DNI James Clapper lied to this committee in 2013, denying the existence of programs that facilitated the mass collection of millions of Americans' phone and internet records, yet was never held accountable. Under John Brennan's leadership, the CIA abused its power to spy on Congress, to dodge oversight, lied about doing it until he was caught, and yet has never been held responsible. Under Biden, the FBI abused its power for political reasons to try to surveil Catholics who attend traditional Latin Mass, labeling them as quote-unquote radical traditionalist Catholics. Personally, just 24 hours after I criticized Kamala Harris and her nomination, I was placed on a secret domestic terror watch list called Quiet Skies. Sadly, there are more examples. The bottom line is this: this must end. President Trump's re-election is a clear mandate from the American people to break this cycle of failure, end the weaponization and politicization of the intelligence community, and begin to restore trust in those who've been charged with the critical task of securing our nation. If confirmed as DNI, I will do my very best to fulfill this mandate and bring leadership to the intelligence community with a laser-like focus on our essential mission, ensuring the safety, security, and freedom of the American people. As the president's principal intelligence advisor, I'll begin by leading by example, checking my own personal views at the door and committing to delivering intelligence that is collected, analyzed, and reported without bias, prejudice, or political influence. I enlisted in the Army because of the horrific terrorist attack on September 11th. And volunteered to deploy to Iraq in 2005, where I served in a medical unit. After nearly 22 years in uniform with 3 combat deployments to the Middle East and Africa, I'm now a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve, where I serve as a battalion commander of soldiers in Oklahoma, Missouri, and Arkansas. I served in Congress for 8 years on the Homeland Security, Foreign Affairs, and Armed Services committees. And it's my experience in the military and in the halls of Congress that have given me a deep understanding of the complex challenges that our nation faces. In both roles, engaging with world leaders, in both roles, being privy to highly classified intelligence. So I know firsthand how essential accurate, unbiased, and timely intelligence is to the president, to Congress, and to our warfighters. I also know the heavy cost of intelligence failures and abuses. Senator Collins, you led the creation of ODNI specifically to address those intelligence failures of 9/11 and Iraq's so-called WMDs. The need for the ODNI under strong leadership still exists today. If confirmed, I'll bring my experience and fresh eyes to leading the intelligence community. And my day one priorities will be to assess the global threat environment, identify where gaps in our intelligence exist, integrate intelligence elements, increase information sharing, and ensure that unbiased, apolitical, objective collection and analysis to support the president and policymakers' decision-making occur. I'll work to end the politicization of the intelligence community and ensure there is a clear mission focus in the IC on its core mission of this unbiased, apolitical collection and analysis of intelligence to secure our nation. I'll work to rebuild trust through transparency and accountability. This is a national security imperative. And I'll work to assess and address efficiencies, redundancies, and effectiveness across ODNI to ensure focus of personnel and resources is on our core mission of national security. Now, in my meetings that I've had with many of you, you expressed bipartisan frustration about recent intelligence failures, as well as the lack of responsiveness to your requests for information. Whether it's the surprise October 7th Hamas terrorist attack, to the sudden takeover of Syria by Islamist extremists, failures to identify the source of COVID, anomalous health incidents, UAPs, drones, and more. If confirmed, I look forward to working with you to address these issues. Ensuring the safety, security, and freedom of the American people is a mandate of leadership that rises above partisan politics. If confirmed, my commitment to the president, to you, and to the American people is this: I will do my very best to find the truth, no matter where it leads, and share that truth with President Trump, his advisors, and you in Congress, providing you with that unbiased, timely, and accurate intelligence as you make the tough decisions that will impact the safety, security, and freedom of the American people. Now, before I close, I want to warn the American people who are watching at home. You may hear lies and smears in this hearing that will challenge my loyalty to and my love for our country. Those who oppose my nomination imply that I am loyal to something or someone other than God, my own conscience, and the Constitution of the United States. Accusing me of being Trump's puppet, Putin's puppet, Assad's puppet, a guru's puppet, Modi's puppet, not recognizing the absurdity of simultaneously being the puppet of five different puppet masters. The same tactic was used against President Trump and failed. The American people elected President Trump with a decisive victory and mandate for change. The fact is, what truly unsettles my political opponents is I refuse to be their puppet. I have no love for Assad or Gaddafi or any dictator. I just hate Al-Qaeda. I hate that we have leaders who cozy up to Islamist extremists, minimizing them to so-called rebels. As Jake Sullivan said to Hillary Clinton, quote, Al-Qaeda is on our side in Syria. Well, Syria is now controlled by an Al-Qaeda offshoot, HTS, led by an Islamist jihadist who danced in the streets on 9/11 and who was responsible for the killing of many American service members. Democrat senators in the past resorted to anti-Christian bigotry against some of President Trump's judicial nominees like Amy Coney Barrett and Brian Boucher. I condemn those actions as a Democrat in Congress at the time, as religious bigotry must be thoroughly condemned by all of us, no matter the religion. Unfortunately, there are some Democrat senators who still don't understand the principle of freedom of religion and Article 6 of the Constitution. Quote, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification to any office or public trust under the United States. Unfortunately, they're once again using the religious bigotry card, but this time trying to foment religious bigotry against Hindus and Hinduism. If anyone is sincerely interested in knowing more about my own personal spiritual path of Hinduism, I welcome you to go to my account on X, where I'll share more on this topic. If confirmed as Director of National Intelligence, I will continue to live by the oath that I have sworn at least 8 times in my life, both in uniform and as a member of Congress. I will support and defend our God-given freedoms enshrined in the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same. Thank you very much for your time. I look forward to your questions.
So fair play to Tulsi. Let's see how she gets on. And it's nice to see somebody that we have championed in years gone by managing to get into some sort of position. I mean, certainly he's much better. Imagine John Bolton, who was one of the previous guys in that role, complete and utter loon and maniac. You know, so Tulsi makes a refreshing change. Well done, Donald Trump. Anyway, another thing which is going to be changing big time over there is these White House press conferences, which I think are going to be much more interesting rather than just loads and loads and loads of paid liars to Stonewall. We've got this lady called Caroline Leavitt with a K, Caroline Leavitt, L-E-A-V-I-T-T, another great surname, you know, no, we don't want to go there, Leavitt. So here she is briefing members of the media and talking quite a lot about who's going to be in these press conferences, who isn't, and also saying it's not just us. You, press, have got a duty to tell the truth.
According to recent polling from Gallup, Americans' trust in mass media has fallen to a record low. Millions of Americans, especially young people, have turned from traditional television outlets and newspapers to consume their news from podcasts, blogs, social media, and other independent outlets. It's essential to our team that we share President Trump's message everywhere and adapt this White House to the new media landscape in 2025. To do this, I am excited to announce the following changes will be made to this historic James S. Brady briefing room, where Mr. Brady's legacy will endure. This White House believes strongly in the First Amendment, so it's why our team will work diligently to restore the press passes of the 440 journalists whose passes were wrongly revoked by the previous administration. We're also opening up this briefing room to new media voices who produce news-related content and whose outlet is not already represented by one of the seats in this room. We welcome independent journalists, podcasters, social media influencers, and content creators to apply for credentials to cover this White House. And you can apply now on our new website, whitehouse.gov/newmedia. Starting today, this seat in the front of the room, which is usually occupied by the press secretary's staff, will be called the new media seat. My team will review the applications and give credentials to new media applicants who meet our criteria and pass United States Secret Service requirements to enter the White House complex. So in light of these announcements, our first questions for today's briefing will go to these new media members whose outlets, despite being some of the most viewed news websites in the country, have not been given seats in this room. And before I turn to questions, I do have news directly from the President of the United States that was just shared with me in the Oval Office from President Trump directly, an update on the New Jersey drones. After research and study, the drones that were flying over New Jersey in large numbers were authorized to be flown by the FAA for research and various other reasons. Many of these drones were also hobbyists, recreational and private individuals that enjoy flying drones. In time, it got worse due to curiosity. This was not the enemy. A statement from the President of the United States to start this briefing with some news. And with that, I will turn it over to questions. And we will begin with our new media members, Mike Allen from Axios, Matt Boyle from Breitbart. Mike, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you very much. Caroline, does the President see anything fishy about deep sea, either its origins or its cost? And could China's ability to make these models quicker, cheaper, affect our thinking about expanding generation data centers, chip manufacturing?
Sure. The President was asked about DeepSeek last night on Air Force One when he gaggled for, I think, the third or fourth time throughout the weekend with members of the traveling press corps. The President said that he believes that this is a wake-up call to the American AI industry. The last administration sat on their hands and allowed China to rapidly develop this AI program. And so President Trump believes in restoring American AI dominance. And that's why he took very strong executive action this past week to sign executive orders to roll back some of the onerous regulations on the AI industry. And President Trump has also proudly appointed the first AI and crypto czar at this White House, David Sacks, whom I spoke with yesterday, very knowledgeable on this subject, and his team is here working every single day to ensure American AI dominance. As for the national security implications, I spoke with NSC this morning. They are looking into what those may be, and when I have an update, I will share it with you, Mike.
Carolyn, you say restore U.S. dominance. Is there a fear that the U.S. either is fallen or has fallen behind? And how would the President make sure the U.S. stays ahead?
No, the President is confident that we will restore American dominance in AI.
Yeah, so, Caroline, first of all, thank you to you and President Trump for actually giving voices to new media outlets that represent millions and millions of Americans. The thing I would add, I've got a two-part question for you. The first is just can you expand upon what steps the White House is going to take to bring more voices, not less, which is what our founder, Andrew Breitbart, believed in, into this room where they rightfully belong?
Yeah. Absolutely. And as I said in my opening statement, Matt, it is a priority of this White House to honor the First Amendment. And it is a fact that Americans are consuming their news media from various different platforms, especially young people. And as the youngest press secretary in history, thanks to President Trump, I take great pride in opening up this room to new media voices to share the President's message with as many Americans as possible. In doing so, number one, we will ensure that outlets like yours, Axios and Breitbart, which are widely respected and viewed outlets, have an actual seat in this room every day. We also, again, encourage anybody in this country, whether you are a TikTok content creator, a blogger, a podcaster, if you are producing legitimate news content, no matter the medium, you will be allowed to apply for press credentials to this White House. And as I said earlier, our new media website is whitehouse.gov/newmedia. And so we encourage people to apply. Again, as long as you are creating news-related content of the day and you're a legitimate independent journalist, you're welcome to cover this White House.
And secondly, Caroline, you said you laid out several of the actions that President Trump has taken. Obviously, it's a stark contrast to the previous administration and breakneck speed from President Trump. Can we expect that pace to continue as the first 100 days moves along here and beyond that?
Absolutely. There's no doubt President Trump has always been the hardest working man in politics. I think that's been proven over the past week. This president has again signed more than 300 executive orders. He's taken historic action. I gaggled aboard Air Force One to mark the first 100 days of this administration, 4 p.m. last Friday, our first 100 hours, rather. And this president did more in the first 100 hours than the previous president did in the first 100 days. So, President Trump, I think you can all expect for him to continue to work at this breakneck speed, so I hope you're all ready to work very hard. I know that we are. Zeke Miller.
Thanks, Caroline. A question that we've asked your predecessors of both parties in this job. When you're up here in this briefing room speaking to the American public, do you view yourself and your role as speaking on advocating on behalf of the president or providing the unvarnished truth, that is, you know, not to lie, not to obfuscate, to the American people?
I commit to telling the truth from this podium every single day. I commit to speaking on behalf of the President of the United States. That is my job. And I will say it's very easy to speak truth from this podium when you have a president who is implementing policies that are wildly popular with the American people. And that's exactly what this administration is doing. It's correcting the lies and the wrongs of the past 4 years, many of the lies that have been told to your faces in this very briefing room. I will not do that. But since you brought up truth, Zeke, I would like to point out, while I vow to provide the truth from this podium, we ask that all of you in this room hold yourselves to that same standard. We know for a fact there have been lies that have been pushed by many legacy media outlets in this country about this president, about his family, and we will not accept that. We will call you out when we feel that your reporting is wrong or there is misinformation about this White House. So, yes, I will hold myself to the truth, and I expect everyone in this room to do the same.
Caroline, leave it there. The new press secretary under Donald Trump. Hopefully there's going to be a little bit more to these press conferences. She is the new press secretary. Caroline, leave it. Let's see how she gets on. Be great to have. Maybe we could go into there and ask a few awkward questions. What would they be about, I wonder? MK Ultra. How about CIA people? Taking over the CIA, the Dulles brothers, will they release the files about the links with the Nazis? What about the Trinity test? Whether they used Nazi technology to blow up the Trinity test and in the all the technology used for the plutonium bombs, that's Fat Man. And the initial nuclear weapons used on the Japanese. So there's a few suggestions of questions that might be asked. Historical as well. I mean, this is what they're now talking about, is opening the archives, which sounds great. Let's see if they actually manage to do that. And also, we have this week the confirmation hearing for RFK Jr., don't we? So he has a couple of... We're going to hear now a couple of people having a go at him. That is... both Democrats, Nancy Pelosi and Bernie Sanders. Now, Bernie has always come across as Mr. Nice Guy, but of course he's not really, is he? He's been supporting all these vaccines and the vaccine companies, and as does Pelosi. Let's have a listen to see how RFK Jr., the new health secretary in the States, deals with questions from them at his confirmation hearing.
We've increased the price of Medicare by 60% over the last 4 years. The target population is being robbed.
With that said,
other options. I agree with President Trump that every abortion is a tragedy. I agree with him that we cannot be a moral nation if we have 1.2 million abortions a year. I agree with him that the states should control abortion. President Trump has told me that he wants to end late-term abortions, and he wants to protect conscience exemptions, and that he wants to end federal funding for abortions here or abroad. That's Title 10. I'm going to I serve at the pleasure of the president. I'm going to implement his policies.
So here's an easy question. Will you commit that when you leave this job, you will not accept compensation from a drug company, a medical device company, a hospital system, or a health insurer for at least 4 years, including as a lobbyist or a board member?
Can you just repeat the last part of the question? Can I commit?
You're not going to take money from drug companies in any way, shape, or form.
Who? Me?
Yes, you.
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to commit to that.
Okay. I want to know if you will commit right now that not only will you not go to work for drug companies, you won't go to work suing the drug companies and taking your rake out of that while you're a secretary and for 4 years after. It's just...
I'll commit to not taking any fees from drug companies while I'm secretary.
No. I'm asking about fees from suing drug companies. Will you agree not to do that?
You're asking me to not sue drug companies.
No,
and I'm not going to agree to that,
Senator. You can sue drug companies as much as you want.
I'm not going to agree to not sue drug companies or anybody.
And I'm asking you to commit right now that you will not take a financial stake in every one of those lawsuits so that what you do as secretary will also benefit you financially down the line.
I'll comply with all the ethical guidelines.
That's not the question. You have said
you're asking me, Senator, you're asking me not to sue pharmaceutical companies.
No, I am not.
Yeah, you are. That's exactly what you're doing.
No. Look, no one should be fooled here. As Secretary of HHS, Robert Kennedy will have the power to undercut vaccines and vaccine manufacturing across our country. And for all of his talk about follow the science and his promise that he won't interfere with those of us who want to vaccinate his kids, the bottom line is the same. Kennedy can kill off access to vaccines and make millions of dollars while he does it. Kids might die, but Robert Kennedy can keep cashing in.
Senator, I support vaccines. I support the childhood schedule. I will do that. The only thing I want is good science, and that's it.
I think the gist of what you're trying to say today is you're really pro-vaccine. You want to ask questions. You have started a group called the Children's Health Defense. You're the originator. Right now, as I understand it, on their website, they are selling what's called onesies. These are little things, clothing for babies. One of them is titled Unfaxed, Unafraid. Next one, and they're sold for $26 a piece, by the way. Next one is No Vax, No Problem. Now, you're coming before this committee, and you say you're pro-vaccine. Just want to ask some questions. And yet your organization is making money selling a child's product to parents for $26, which casts fundamental doubt on the usefulness of vaccines. Can you tell us now that you will, now that you are pro-vaccine, that you're going to have your organization take these products off the market?
Senator, I have no power over that organization. I'm not part of it. I resigned from the board.
That was just a few months ago. You founded that. You certainly have power. You can make that vote. Are you supportive of this?
I've had nothing to do with
leadership. Are you supportive of these onesies?
I'm supportive of vaccines.
Are you supportive of this clothing, which is militantly anti-vaccine?
I am supportive of vaccines. Right. I want good science, and I want to protect
the vaccine. You will not tell the organization you founded not to continue selling that product. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're having epidemics of all these chronic illnesses, autoimmune diseases, neurological diseases, allergic diseases, obesity. When my uncle was president, 3% of Americans were obese. Today, 74% of Americans are obese or overweight. No other country has anything like this. In Japan, the obesity rate is still 3%. And epidemics are not caused by genes. Genes may provide the vulnerability, but you need an environmental toxin. Oh, something is poisoning the American people. And we know that the primary culprits are changing food supply, the switch to highly chemical intensive processed foods. We have 10,000 ingredients in our country, in our foods. The Europeans have only 400. If you buy McDonald's French fries in our country, there's 11 ingredients, my understanding. In Europe, there's only 3. If you buy Fruit Loops in our country, they're loaded with food dyes, with yellow dye, red dye, blue dye, and many other ingredients. The same company makes the same product with different ingredients for Canada and Europe. And at age, we don't have good science on all these things. And that is deliberate. That's a deliberate choice not to study the things that are truly making us sick, that are not only contributing to chronic disease, but to mortalities from infectious disease. We need to get a handle on this, because if we don't, it's an existential threat. Our country is not going to be destroyed because we get the marginal tax rate wrong, or because we get one of these culture war issues that we've been talking about today wrong. It's going to be destroyed if we continue down this trajectory of chronic disease. We need to fix our food supply, and that's the number one. Farmers are using seeds and chemicals that are, over the long term, are costing them and us. And what we need to do is we need to support the farmers. We need the farmers as partners if we're going to make them work. And I don't want a single farmer to go out of business under our watch. I don't regulate farms. If I'm privileged to be confirmed, I'm not regulating farms. That's under USDA. But I want to partner with all of my decisions with USDA and with the farm community to make sure that we don't lose more farmers in this country.
RFK Jr. there, answering questions from Nancy Pelosi and Bernie Sanders to see. I mean, you think he's being pretty assertive, isn't he? And he's absolutely right, of course, to say that science is disputed and he wants good science. That is to say, science that really does stand up, and it's not all to do with just making loads of money out of conning the public, poisoning the public and conning the government. So what about the whole position of US and Europe? This is one of my little themes over the last few weeks, has been who is in charge? Is it Britain or Europe? Well, it does look, I mean, Mandelson is still slated as going to be the ambassador. I don't know if he's even been over there yet. Maybe he's there now trying to negotiate his own job. But for me, Mandelson and the number two choice apparently is David Miliband, who's possibly even worse, well known in the States as a deep state boy. Is Trump going to accept these people? Does he have to accept them? Why have we got political appointees rather than professional civil servants doing these jobs? Lots and lots of questions. But what I'm trying to tease out here is that this will really, the answer to whether Mandelson succeeds in becoming ambassador to the United States from Britain is really going to tell you who's in charge. Is Britain in charge or is the US in charge? I mean, I've got some sneaking suspicions, rather seeded in my mind through LaRouche Public Affairs Committee, people like Harley Schlanger, etc., that actually the Brits, I mean, if you go back to the American War of Independence, once the British realised they kind of lost this American War of Independence, they had a meeting at Bowood House in Wiltshire, which is near Chippenham. I drive past it from time to time. They've got a golf course. I've done a bit of trespassing over there in over the years. At Bowood House, there was a meeting where British Foreign Office people and Freemasons all decided, look, we can't win this war. It's too far away. They're too strong. That they basically booted us out because they don't want to take our money system. But rather than try and fight them militarily, which I think we'd probably lose, we are going to infiltrate them using Freemasonry. That was decided. Now, this is all in the book Who We Are by Anton Chaitkin. Anton Chaitkin is the son, as you probably know by now if you've been listening to the show for a while, he's the son of Jacob Chaitkin, who was the chief lawyer and advisor to the Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany during World War II, or before World War II, actually, in the United States of America. And this is the boycott. The Zionists broke the boycott. The Zionists busted it. And so anyway, Anton's book is Who We Are. And he talks about that in there, this idea that rather than fight them militarily, the British were going to try and infiltrate the United States through Freemasonry. So this all comes back to LaRouche Pack and this whole idea that actually in this secret society hierarchy, Britain still does have massive amounts of sway over what happens in the United States. And in a way, it's a kind of front organisation for Britain. So they're the big guys, you know, they're kicking everyone around, booting all, they're doing all these deals with the Nazis, as my book The Traitors of Arnhem has absolutely shown, I think. The British were every bit as in bed with the Nazis much more quietly, though, than the Americans. The Americans had their Operation Paperclip. There was all sorts going on there, rocket scientists and everything. But the Brits, look, we took all the money. We took that $1 billion from Bormann at the end of the war. So we were, in effect, bigger traitors to all those people that died in the war. Maybe we didn't really care too much about them. We cared even less about the Russians. We really cared about the money. Who knows? Anyway, I'm rambling a bit here. But let's get back to... let's get back to Scott Ritter, who's chatting here to George Galloway. We heard a bit of a clip of that right at the very start. But George Galloway, about Britain and America. So does America really respect Britain? Are you going to get a different attitude, aren't you, with Donald Trump?
If I wanted to play the game, if I wanted to be on MSNBC or CNN, or if I wanted to be a guest speaker in the Council for Foreign Relations, if I wanted to give testimony at the United States Senate, I would be falling in defense of the rules-based international order. I would be speaking about the nobility of the American obligation to NATO, 80 years of, you know, solid brotherly love. But then I'd be a liar. You see, I've been saying in the lead up well before Donald Trump became president, and I've been warning people, especially Europeans, you're not our friend. We have never viewed you as our friend. You are a tool that we use to achieve the objectives we want, that you don't have a voice, you don't have a vote. That is the reality. We throw you bits and pieces, but at the end of the day, we will use you and, if necessary, break you to achieve what we want. And when I was saying that, everybody's going, oh, yeah, great, Scott. Oh, that's the Scott Ritter we love. And I say, okay, but now we got a president that's doing exactly that. Oh, my God, you're a shill for Trump. No, I'm not. I'm just telling you the way it is. Because I'm sitting here telling you the reality of Donald Trump's posture vis-a-vis the rest of the world does not mean that I support what Donald Trump is doing. What it means is that I recognize that for the first time, we have a president who's actually being honest about how America views the rest of the world. And maybe it's time for you to wake up out of the little slumber party you were having, Europe, and recognize we don't like you. We didn't ask you to cut yourself off from cheap Russian gas because we cared about you. We did it because we wanted to destroy Russia using you as the tool. How does it feel? I mean, go listen to Bob Dylan's song, Like a Rolling Stone, and ask yourself the question, how does it feel? Because that's what we're doing to you. That's what we've done to you. We just finally have a president that's being honest about it. I'm not sitting here saying that I applaud what Trump is doing. I'm sitting here saying that this is a necessary dysfunction if we're ever going to get out of where we were collectively together. I prefer to work with a Europe that's proud of itself, a Europe that defines itself not as a collective homogeneous nothing, but as a collection of sovereign states. I like it when Italians are Italians, when French are French, when Germans are Germans, when the British are the British. That's how I like Europe. I don't like this thing called European Union, because what the hell is it? It's nothing. It's simply something that we can use. We weaken your national identity. We impose an artificial political, whatever you want to call it, over you, and then we use you and abuse you, and then we will toss you away. And you're in the process of being tossed away right now.
Scott Ritter there talking to His Lordship George Galloway on the Moats program, I imagine, leader of the Workers' Party of Britain. And so that is all about Britain and America, who's in charge. Well, you know, it's just going to be interesting, isn't it? It's a real tug of war going on between these two very major parts of the Anglo-Zionist Empire, the British that created Israel and America over the centuries. Can the British still retain their occult control over these countries? Or maybe one of those other countries is now controlling Britain. Who knows? Bit P2, isn't it? These little secret committees. We'll be hearing a bit about that in a minute too. So anyway, we also hear this week some more from Scott Ritter, where he speaks to a guy called Martin Karbowski and the Bulgarians. This is really looking at, you know, who is Trump. This is Scott Ritter's doing a very good job, I think, on explaining what Trump's foreign policy is going to be, much better than Trump himself, and looking at Ukraine particularly, and free speech generally, you know, the attitude of Musk, and are we going to have free speech? So Martin Karbowski is a Bulgarian. So this is from Bulgarians who support the West are traitors, basically. I think it's called the interview. But so here's Scott Ritter again there talking to this Bulgarian guy.
You like Trump very much.
No, I am a person who believes in the Constitution of the United States of America. And I don't believe Trump understands the Constitution. And I'm very nervous about what Trump's going to do as president of the United States. I think that his approach towards solving the problem in Ukraine is has the chance of succeeding. And so I support it. But don't conflate that with I like Trump very much. If you've studied my writings on Trump, I don't like Trump very much. I think he's a threat to the American way of life. But unfortunately, the American way of life has failed. And Trump is saying that he's going to do something different. And he has the support of tens of millions of Americans. So America is going to be redefining itself over the course of the next decade. I do think that to call Trump a Republican is a mistake. He's not a Republican. The Republican Party, the Republican Party that I joined, is dead. Trump is MAGA. It's something totally different.
Trump is what?
MAGA, Make America Great Again.
MAGA, yeah. Okay, last question for Ukraine. Did the USA need Ukraine as an anti-Russian state forever?
No. If you listen to everybody talk about Ukraine was lured, and I can provide a little backstory to this. In 1997, I traveled to Kiev as a United Nations inspector, trying to get the government, I think Kuchma was the prime minister at the time, and trying to get the Kuchma government to stop black marketeers. There were certain Ukrainians that were going into former Soviet defense establishments and taking material and selling it on the black market. And one of them was selling equipment to Iraq. And I was to say, you can't do that. That's a violation of the sanctions and so, such. It was interesting. The National Security Council of Kuchma was supportive. The FSB, or I guess the SBU, was not supportive. In fact, I had to leave Ukraine early because I was told that they're going to kill me. That's how upset they were. The corruption was unreal. In order for me to get an audience, I had to meet with three senior members of the Ukrainian government who, because I was an American, said, we need you to promise that you will write a letter to your government saying that Ukraine is a worthy member of NATO and that Ukraine should be a member of NATO. We want to be a member of NATO. And I said, but I'm a United Nations official. But you're an American, but I'm a United Nations official. I'm here on United Nations business. They never understood that. And, so they just assumed that I would write that letter because I was an American. But my point is, Ukraine's always been under the belief that it had to be a member of NATO to expand and survive. NATO never wanted Ukraine to be a member. Ukraine is a horrible member. It doesn't qualify on any level. It's the most corrupt place in the world. Why would we want Ukraine to be a member? They're not democratic. It's an oligarchy. It's horrible. But we lied to the Ukrainians. And we let them to believe that they could be a member because we wanted to use the Ukrainians. Remember, the best tool, and every Ukrainian is a tool. We talked about blackmail for a president. The best tool is the tool that wants to be used, that believes that by being used, it's achieving a greater purpose. You don't want a tool that knows it's just a tool. If they know they're just a tool, they're not going to commit. We have lied and deceived the Ukrainian people, the Ukrainian nation, about what our intents are. We will never allow them to be a member of NATO. It was never in the plans for them to be a member of NATO. Every time somebody talks about it, it's a lie, and they know it's a lie. But the Ukrainians continue to believe the lie, and that's the hope that allows them to continue to sacrifice, you know, so many people on the battlefield, that if they just hold out for a period of time, they can become a member of NATO. They will never be a member of NATO. They were never intended to be a member of NATO. They were always intended to be a tool to be used and, if needed, destroyed and discarded in the larger project of bringing down Vladimir Putin's Russia.
Yesterday, you see, Mark Zuckerberg made a shocking U-turn and announced that he will be removing censorship. How do you comment on this fact?
How do I comment on this? We know that the FBI, Department of Justice, Department of State, and the Biden administration itself put pressure on American social media platforms to censor. We know this. It's not a matter of debate. The House Intelligence Committee and the House Judiciary Committee have published documents proving that the FBI reached out to suppress accounts. And we know the Biden administration has also done this. I'm personally impacted by this because they have suppressed my social media profile because they don't like what I'm saying. Mark Zuckerberg is one of those who has done that. That was because in order to survive in the Biden administration, you had to play their game. Well, there's a new chief in town, a game-changing chief, as we talked about, and his name is Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is backed up by somebody who's not elected but very powerful and influential. That's Elon Musk. And Elon Musk has built his reputation as being the defender of free speech and buying the X platform or Twitter platform, making it X. And it's today the most powerful social media platform out there. It's surpassed anything else. And Zuckerberg is looking at it and saying, my business model has failed. Nobody trusts me anymore. They don't believe in the integrity of my what I've done here because I sold out to the government. And so it's a business decision. Mark Zuckerberg didn't wake up in the morning and say, I suddenly believe in free speech. He doesn't believe in free speech. Mark Zuckerberg believes in making money. And Facebook, Meta, is a vehicle to make money. In order to do that, people have to have confidence in the product they're using. And right now in America, nobody has confidence in Facebook. It is a totally corrupted platform. And so I think Zuckerberg's trying to make a difference. But it's half-hearted. He still says, I will have people who enforce certain rules and certain this. For instance, what's he going to do about criticism of Israel when the U.S. government continues to say that any criticism of Israel constitutes anti-Semitism, and therefore it's hate speech and needs to be suppressed? Is Zuckerberg going to suppress that? Elon Musk is. He's Mr. Free Speech, but no. You can't really criticize Israel on X. You get suppressed. You get shadow banned. You get banned outright, depending on who you are and what you are. So this is just a game. It's just a silly game being played by Zuckerberg to try and win back an audience that I think he's lost. I think Meta isn't going to recover from this. X took the lead. X is defining things, and X is out-competing Facebook right now. So we'll see what happens to Zuckerberg, but he should have done what Elon Musk did, stand up to the government, say not just no, but hell no. Free speech is free speech. The First Amendment is the First Amendment. But there's another aspect of Facebook that you should be aware of.
What?
It willingly allows its data to be accessed by the intelligence services of the United States and its allies. So in many ways, this is a ploy. No more fact checkers. It's a free speech platform.
Yeah.
Everybody goes, oh, great. And they write, and the intelligence services are sitting there writing down everything you're writing down. So beware of the gift that looks too good.
Yeah, I understand. Is it possible a war inside NATO?
Yeah.
Yeah, where?
What if Denmark wants to oppose the United States? What if Denmark wants to oppose the United States? You have France right now threatening the United States with the potential of war. Bring it on, France. Really, I mean, we haven't killed a Frenchman in a long time. We'll kill you all. Again, I don't know what Europe thinks is going to happen here. Is Europe going to beat the United States? This is Donald Trump. He's a game changer. He doesn't care about you. There's no romance in his heart for Europe. He views you as a problem. You're a disease. You're a sick continent that he wants to get away from. He doesn't want to pay you to rebuild yourselves. You're on your own. And if you want to play games with America, our bombs blow up your buildings as well as they blow up anybody else's. You have no power. Great Britain has a nuclear deterrence. Not the moment we turn it off, they don't. France will sink all their submarines. I mean, I don't know what Europe thinks it's going to do. They fell into the NATO trap. The NATO trap means that you are forever a colony of America. Now America decides we don't want the colony because the colony's broken. But the colony can't fight us. You have no strength. What military power does Europe have today? Name one military power institution out there can stand up to the United States. There isn't one. Europe is a joke. They have no military viability. But the Europeans, they're going to be shocked about how they're going to be treated now. We're done treating you as friends. You're not our friends. You've betrayed us. And this is the thing I tried to warn the Europeans about. When Trump got elected, instead of reaching out a hand of friendship, Europe worked with the Biden administration to Trump-proof policy, to stab Trump in the back, to create complications in Ukraine and Europe that forced Trump to stay in. You shouldn't have done that, because Trump hates you now.
Scott Ritter, talking to Martin Karbowski. I mean, it's quite difficult to find that because it's all in Cyrillic, which I guess is some sort of Bulgarian type language. I thought Bulgarian was a bit more like English looking letters, but no, apparently not. Anyway, it's a great, or maybe it's just done for the Russian audience. Maybe it's that simple, eh? So Catherine Austin Fitz is also someone we hear from quite a lot on this program. Here she's talking to Alex Jones. I don't often have programs with him on. I was sent this one. This is quite good. And here is, I mean, it's for the longer interview, as with those last two from Scott Ritter, I'll be putting them up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, as well as the interview with Caroline. Well, it's not an interview, is it? The press conference with Caroline Leavitt. Here is Catherine Austin Fitz. Alex Jones sort of interrupts her quite a bit in this very annoying fashion. I mean, he just talks over and he shouts the whole time. He's the most annoying person. Alex Jones, right. I mean, he's got this whole sort of fake Bill Cooper. It's what it seems to me is Alex Jones. He arrived on the scene as Bill Cooper was massively popular back in the around about 2000, late 90s, 2000. And he was trying to do the same kind of thing as Bill Cooper, without the brains, without the faith, without the insight, without the background knowledge. And so he just puts himself across as a shock jock. I find him really irritating. One of the best things he ever did, of course, was that interview with Aaron Russo. So he's got access to some great stuff, but he just as a person, I find him very, very annoying and disingenuous about 9/11. He spent years looking into 9/11 and proving that it was nothing to do with the Muslims, but he's now hating all Muslims again, which is, of course, what he's supposed to do if he's working for Israel. He also did this whole business of Sandy Hook, very much like Richard D. Hall here in Britain with the Manchester bombing, the Manchester Arena bomb, where they say, oh, no, it didn't really happen. It was all a hoax. Yeah, right. And what you do then is you turn the people who've lost their loved ones into the so-called perpetrators. This is sick. It's disgusting. And it's designed to sort of get the internet closed down and independent journalism restricted. And so very annoying. But anyway, here is Alex Jones, and well, very little of Alex Jones, mostly Catherine Austin Fitz, where she talks about how the globalists are actually engaged in this kind of what she calls a secret omni-war designed to collapse humanity.
Let's go back to what Trump can do and what we can do, because there is a huge amount we can do. You know, what we can't do is we can't say, oh, we're going to get Trump elected or we're going to get Bobby into HHS and that's going to solve the problem. No, this is trench warfare. You have to fight this. You know, I told somebody the other day, if Bobby gets into HHS, you know, that's just pulling into the starting gate. We're an army and we have to fight with him every day, day in, day out for the next 4 years. That's how it works. It's trench warfare. But there's a huge amount you can do. The first thing the federal government can do is they can bring transparency to how the federal money works place by place. Because, you know, yes, you have a small handful of people centralizing wealth, but as they centralize it, they shrink it. And a lot of that is working through the federal budget. And if we can see what is happening with the federal money, with the appropriations, with the credit and the regulations in our county and neighborhood, in the world that we walk around and see, we can shift the money, because a lot of the money is being spent or used illegally. We can shift that. One of the things Trump can do right away is rescind FASB 56. It's an administrative policy, but it is creating incredible secrecy and darkness, which is very, very, very dangerous. The other thing he can do is it's fine to encourage digital technology, but we need to encourage analog technology, because if we go to an all digital monetary system, we're talking about a digital concentration camp. And if you combine an all digital monetary system with the kind of data centers and mRNA tech, you know, Internet of Bodies technology he's talking about, you're talking about a slavery system. So there's a great deal that Trump can do to encourage analog systems, including cash. We just saw the Norwegian Central Bank come out and say, you know, we're down to 3% cash in Norway. That was a mistake. If you look at what is happening in all these disasters around the world, people who have cash are okay. We need to take cash back. And so, in fact, they're going to do everything they can to encourage the use of cash. There's a great many things. If you look at our presentation on what the states could do, you know, there's a great amount that can do. Now, the other thing Trump can do, and this has happened before and it can happen again, if you look at the disclosure, if we were to map out all the federal money in your neighborhood or your county and map out the credit, map out the appropriations, map out the loans, map out all the different cash and credit flows, what we would see is there's tremendous opportunity to re-engineer them in a way that create explosive new wealth, particularly because when you combine lots of new technology with healthy small enterprise and small farms, there's incredible opportunity, including to build new regenerative farms that feed people healthy food instead of making them sick. So that opportunity is there. But what it will require is the federal government being exceptionally liberal about allowing local government and state government to change the rules and all the terms and conditions.
Catherine Austin Fitz, I think she's really good on sort of as an insider in looking at how you deal with these people. And also, you know, it's not going to change everything. Just having people like Gabbard and RFK in key roles, everyone has to get in behind them and help them. So that's what she's effectively saying there. But I think she's right. You know, that's what we're dealing with. The omni-war designed to collapse humanity. That's what's going on. And they decided that they're going to rebuild humanity the way they want it, if they get away with it. I've got a lovely little poem from Patrizia this week, which is about Donald Trump. Ode, Truth or Liar, the Don's on fire. Thank you, Patrizia. The Davos crew, all ghouls, tis true, all sat in line to see Trump do a turnaround. Kicked them to the curb. Protectionist, they think absurd. Seething anger, fuming sparks, his face on screen, oh, what a lark. Divide and rule, Trump now the boss, the Davos crew now at a loss. Bin Salman's deal said to be a billion, Trump rounds with the deal up to a trillion. The business world e'er be Trump's minions. Some call him mad, some call him crazy, deluded, crass, but never lazy. Run rings round the Davos crew who think they rule our world, 'tis true. Trump's camp, his ear, seems has got misinformation, now not such rot. In time will tell what game he plays, but what a treat to see him slay the double-dealing Davos crew who want us dead, this much is true. One thing for certain, no Davos schmoozing, Trump's orders borders of his choosing. His team elite, the Don's on fire, in time will tell, be truth or liar. Thank you, Patrizia. Finally, the mid-air collision. This is an interesting one. I have a report on that, and I'll tell you what I think about it in a minute, because I do like to look at these, particularly air crashes.
With the morning light came the dark news. Search teams who'd been deployed for hours in and on the icy waters of the Potomac found no survivors.
Despite all those efforts, we are now at a point where we are switching from a rescue operation to a recovery operation.
Moments before the collision, there were warnings from air traffic control.
Pass 25, get the surgery in sight. Pass 25, pass one, it's surgery.
CCTV footage from Reagan National Airport captured what happened next. The investigation will be headed by the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB. Complicating the investigation is that this is a multi-agency operation. You have federal involved, you have state involved, and of course you have the District of Columbia involved as well. President Trump held a news conference describing events as a dark and excruciating night in the nation's history.
We do not know what led to this crash, but we have some very strong opinions and ideas. And I think
we'll probably pivoting from expressing grief, he proceeded to politicize the tragedy, blaming it on the diversity, equality, and inclusion policies of previous administrations.
How you can come to the conclusion right now that diversity had something to do with this crash?
Because I have common sense, okay? And unfortunately, a lot of people don't. I put safety first. Obama, Biden, and the Democrats put policy first. And they put politics at a level that nobody's ever seen.
Away from the politics, faces are being put to the dead. Among them, two world champion Russian figure skaters who'd been coaching the U.S. national team. Just two of the dozens who'll be mourned as the Ronald Reagan National Airport opens again after 14 hours of closure. Mike Hanna, Al Jazeera, Arlington, Virginia.
So the Washington Air crash, very annoying. This helicopter, what the hell is it doing there? No right to be there. Training missions can be all sorts of things. Of course, it's a coverall sort of for black ops and that kind of stuff. Also, the pilot's obviously totally incompetent. He's not looking around. That's what he's supposed to be doing the whole time. Are they training this helicopter pilot? Who's doing the training? And they've ended up just messing about. They think they're above the law. And, of course, the American military are absolutely rubbish. They are absolute cretins. Sorry to say that, but many of them are. And they've been doing the wrong things all around the world. And now they're doing it in Washington, D.C., right under the nose of the president. It's great to see Donald Trump coming out immediately and calling them out. I mean, I know he's had a bit of a go at the air traffic control. It's not air traffic control's fault. You've got clear visibility. You've got flashing lights on these planes. If you're not looking out, if you're just flying about as if you own the sky in the flight path of an airport, this airliner was only 400 feet, so it was just about to touch down. You shouldn't be there, matey. And also, the air traffic control did warn him, told him, get out of the way. They didn't tell the pilot of the airliner that the helicopter was there. Anyway, I mean, the sorts of black ops that these army helicopters do in this country too, people need to be aware. The army is used for all sorts of things because the pilot, I've spoken to pilots, they tell you helicopter pilots particularly get ordered to do missions. They've no idea what's in the back of the helicopter. Someone gets in, a whole group of people get in, they get put down in a field somewhere else. They don't know what's going on behind them. Sometimes they've got large, sort of heavy weights and things with them. But this is a way organized crime can operate within the army. So whatever's in the back there, it could be bodies, it could be drugs. There's no proper checks and balances on what goes on in the forces, particularly here and in America now. And so it'd be interesting to know if there are any other bodies hauled out of the Potomac River that we've not been told about. So nice to see Trump coming out and saying the right thing, basically. Look, calling the army out, I suppose. On to our final occult section. And, I have to play. Well, I don't have to play anything, but I do play this because YouTube censored it. I looked on there the other day and it said, oh, no, this video encourages suicide. Well, it's actually, it does include scenes of the hangman's noose, but this is a Masonic, and it's nothing to do with suicide. It's to do with threats of murder by the Masons. And so this is just an excuse to remove what is a fascinating, brilliant bit of film made by an old mate of mine, Martin Short, who wrote Inside the Brotherhood. So the basic thing is there's these four books. The first one is Jack the Ripper, The Final Solution by Stephen Knight, which looks into the connections between Jack the Ripper and the Royal Family and the Metropolitan Police, and connections to this painter, Walter Sickert, who lived in Whitechapel. And fascinating tale. But anyway, when he did that, loads of Masons said, yeah, you're right, and they gave him loads of information. So Stephen then in the 1980s published a book called The Brotherhood, which is all about Freemasonry, everything that he'd picked up from people who'd been in touch with him after he published the first book about Jack the Ripper. So then after that, Stephen died very, very quickly, probably poisoned or killed in some other way when he was in his 30s. And all the information that he had was passed on to Martin Short. He wrote then a book, published a book a few years later, a couple of years later, pretty quick actually, so maybe so they didn't bump him off too. And that is called Inside the Brotherhood. Very, very good. Thick book all about Freemasonry. From the heart, the belly of the beast, London. And lots of stuff about infiltrating the Masons, etc., I was talking about earlier on. And so then came another book called Born in Blood by Michael Robinson. Michael Robinson, I think it's Michael. But this is really good because it explains how Freemasonry today is just a repetition of the Catholic Templars, which were supposed to have been extinguished in 1307 on Friday the 13th of October. So we just need to understand all this stuff. Look, these guys have been going for centuries. That book, by the way, is a brilliant bit of history, Born in Blood, and it's a great way of understanding what's going on, I think, today with all the dodginess of Freemasonry, how it actually operates. It's satanic at its ultimate roots, ultimately satanic. So here he is. This is a clip from the section on the P2 and the death of Roberto Calvi under Blackfriars Bridge in the 1980s. And this is by Martin Short, his documentary series Inside the Brotherhood he did for Granada Television, I think it was. And it was shown on ITV in the 1980s. And this section of it's about propaganda duo. It's very long. It's about, I think, about 3 hours altogether if you string the whole documentary series together. Italy's secret Masonic government revealed.
When the Italian government gave out publicly the list of the of P2, we were astonished. It was like discovering that Italian democracy was something else from what we had always believed. We saw that there was another something going on underneath the surface of events. And so we asked ourselves why.
The answer goes back to a bitter struggle between Freemasons and the Catholic Church in Italy, which has lasted ever since English gentlemen and sea captains introduced the Brotherhood here in the 1730s. The Church soon branded Freemasonry the work of the devil and excommunicated all Catholic Masons. Italian Freemasonry turned anti-Catholic and revolutionary and went underground. It has had a clandestine and persecuted history ever since. The Grand Orient is Italian Freemasonry's ruling body.
Contrary to what happens in England and America, where the state not only tolerates Freemasonry, but recognizes it, here state and church don't recognize it, but even condemn it without knowing it.
In 1926, Italy's dictator Mussolini banned Freemasonry. After World War II, it was made legal again, and an old secret elite lodge was reborn as Propaganda Due, or P2. This failed to recruit many members, until the Grand Master at the time asked Licio Gelli to take over in 1970. Gelli immediately set about changing the character of P2. Tonight, he speaks out in defense of his lodge.
Militavano nella P2 i migliori uomini.
Inside the P2 lodge, we had the top men Italy had in all fields, in the world of politics, in diplomacy, the top men from industry, the press, the law, and the civil service. They were all the very best. By joining P2, they wanted peace and tranquility within the lodge, so that they could all contribute in their own fields to the betterment of society.
L'uno sia l'altro per poter migliorare la società.
Gelli initiated his P2 elite in a suite in Rome's Excelsior Hotel, not in a Masonic temple. It never met like a conventional lodge. Instead, select groups of members plotted to control the state, as agendas seized at Gelli's premises revealed.
The political and economic situation of Italy, the threat of the Italian Communist Party, aiming at the conquest of power, the spread of immorality, indiscipline, relationships with the Italian state.
We were striving for the improvement of society, to make a contribution, to safeguard the democratic institutions of our country. This was P2.
But in the 1930s and 40s, when Mussolini ruled Italy, Gelli was a dedicated fascist, and he's never been a friend of democracy. After the war, he fled to South America. He returned in the 1960s when he was wealthy, respectable, and an ideal Masonic recruit.
I felt Masonry was the university where one went to learn rules of right and wrong and graduated with a degree in morals, sound principles, and ethics. These were the only reasons I joined the Masons, and I'd join them again. I have been a Mason, I am a Mason, and I shall behave all my life as a Mason.
He's a man that likes darkness. He's a man that likes intrigue. He's a man that says that likes democracy, but has a very strange idea of democracy. He comes from the extreme right. I don't think he has ever left that position. His friends are still the same fascists that he met with during the war.
After the raid on Jelly's villa and the exposure of P2, it became clear that the main aim of the lodge was to subvert democracy. An exhaustive parliamentary inquiry found that P2 was a state within a state, a cell of extreme right-wingers bent on maintaining power by ruthless means. For example, in 1978, Italy's Christian Democrat Prime Minister, Aldo Moro, favored bringing the communists into government in a plan known as the Historic Compromise. But then, Moro's car was ambushed, and he was kidnapped by left-wing terrorists. Evidence which later emerged suggested that the longer Moro was held captive, the better it suited the P2 Masons who headed the secret services.
Chi avrebbe dovuto trovare Aldo Moro?
A committee drawn up from the staff of the Interior Ministry was put in charge of finding Moro. They were nearly all P2 men. Later, I was on the Moro inquiry. I read all the documents, the few there were from that committee, and I must say, dispassionately, that they had no intention of finding Moro. To leave Moro in the hands of the terrorists, to let the situation rot, was a sure way to make sure that the historic compromise did not come to fruition.
Three months after Moro's kidnap, he was found dead in the boot of a car. His body bore the marks of repeated torture. But Italy's body politic had also been mutilated, and the communists have been shut out of government ever since.
I've played a clip from that a few weeks ago, a different clip though. That's Propaganda Due, Italy's secret Masonic government revealed. That's one of the extract from one of the documentaries in the brilliant series by Martin Short, Inside the Brotherhood, which was transmitted on ITV, produced by Granada. So finally, Halo Rock. Who are they? Oh, it's not finally, no, one more after this. Halo Rock, Constantine and the Vatican and the Holy Roman Empire. So Italy, of course, has been a major centre of all this. In 1154, there was this thing called the Great Schism between Constantinople and Rome. So the Roman Church, which had been set up by Constantine in the 4th century, the Roman Emperor, because they couldn't put down the Christians. They were growing. The more they tried to put them down. So they decided we're going to create a fake version of Christianity, which ended up in Rome and was called the Vatican. But anyway, by 1100s, the 12th century, they were starting to fall out with the original church, which had been sent up in Constantinople, which is now Istanbul. So that's the Orthodox Church. And they explain here some of the really dodgy stuff that's been going on at the Vatican. So much as we love the Catholic Church and the Catholic congregations, many of the Catholic priests, the Vatican stinks. I'm sorry, folks. And it's also what Halo Rock here talks about also is links to the Holy Roman Empire.
So yeah, let's dive deep into Constantine's actual belief system. So if you look into it, Constantine was devoted to Mithraism, or the cult of Mithras. And if you do research into Mithras, you'll see that the worshippers of Mithras had a complex system of 7 grades of initiation and communal ritual meals. And initiates, they called themselves initiates, united by the handshake. Oh, that sounds pretty interesting, doesn't it? If very similar to Freemasons. So you can see why the Freemasons are obsessed with Mithras. But the thing about Mithraism was it's pretty much sun worship. And it was like the underground idea of sun worship. So, yes, the Roman Empire worshipped the sun. But behind the scenes, it was represented by Mithra. And Mithra had to do with sacrificing a bull and wearing a hat. But he was pretty much a sun god. Like the underground sun god to the Roman Empire. Like Sol Invictus and Apollo. They were like the outer. What they showed to like the public. But the secret, you know, what the elites worshipped was Mithra. And like they sacrificing bulls, wearing these hats. This is what the secret cult worshipped underground. So yeah, it involved sacrificing a bull during their ceremonies. If you guys remember, I talked about Justin Martyr in part 2. He was one of the people that got persecuted in 145 AD. And he actually talked about the cult of Mithras, and he actually charged them or said that they were imitating Christianity. And this was back in 145 AD, which was, you know, almost 200 years earlier than Constantine. They're already imitating Christianity. So you can see, like, this cult was coming in. They saw Christianity, and they were already infiltrating it. They were already trying to imitate it. They were known to wear these caps called Phrygian caps, I think they're called. Mithraic caps. Sacrificial caps. So it's known as the red cap of liberty. It symbolizes the sacred acts of initiation, sacrifice, liberty, revolution, enlightenment, and brotherhood. These red caps. And they're pretty ancient. Like you could, they go back in time. You could trace them back to Baal, actually. The false god Baal of Canaan, Phoenicians. The child sacrificing god. And the first statue of Baal. Like, if you go look up Baal at Wikipedia, and you go back in time, like, what statue did they, like, the earliest statue of Baal. He's wearing a Phrygian cap, the same cap that Mithras is wearing. And Baal, as you know, is associated with a bull because of Moloch, which is putting a child into a bull-like furnace, right? And it just so happens Mithras is sacrificing a bull. So you can see how it's all connected, right? It's the same cult, this old cult that started in Babylon, worked its way to Egypt, and then into Phoenicians. I talked about this in the origins of the Cabal. The god, and in modern day, this is what the revolutionaries were using. So in the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the caps start popping up everywhere, like in the late 1700s, 1776, 1800s. You start seeing this Mithras cap popping up everywhere again. You're like, what is happening?
Part of a Halo Rock documentary there, Constantine, the Emperor, Roman Emperor, the Vatican to the Holy Roman Empire documentary, which is well worth a good old look at the whole thing. So I'll put that up on our show page just as an audio at thisweek.org.uk. I'll probably put the video up there too. But let's not end on a downbeat note. Like Chris Morris was saying the other week, let's end on an upbeat note. This is a fantastic book. Someone shared this with me on Facebook, just a link to the book. But I discovered there was a lovely interview there called the book is called The Air We Breathe. The author is called Glenn Scrivener. Never come across him anymore. But this is brilliant. I think he's just talking about, the giving us a sort of lead into how to understand the world we are today, to make it an easier, a simpler world to live with Christian values and with God, and why that shouldn't be a really big deal.
It's basically about the fact that we are all far more Christian than we imagine ourselves to be, even if you've never been to church, even if you've never clapped eyes on a Bible. You have been shaped by the Jesus Revolution at the most profound level, and one of the ways you know you've been shaped by it is that you don't know that you've been shaped by it. It's like the air that we breathe. It's like goldfish not knowing that they're swimming in water. They say, "What's water?" It's the very atmosphere of our lives. And yet, we tend to think that Christianity is this other thing off to one side. And what I try to do in the core of the book is go through seven values that Christianity has taught the world that are now second nature to us. And those values are equality, compassion, consent, enlightenment, science, freedom, and progress. And as I teach through those seven values, I actually take the reader from Genesis right through to George Floyd. So in Genesis, we're talking about equality and the image of God. In compassion, we're talking about the coming of Christ and the way that the cross has upended all our notions. And then when I talk about consent, I'm talking about the sort of the sexual revolution that has really shaped this world. Not the 1960s, but the sort of the AD 60s. Go back to the early church. And then I talk about enlightenment, which often we think of the years between the fall of Rome and the Renaissance as the Dark Ages. But actually, I want to talk about there was a heck of a lot more light going on in those years than we usually imagine. And then science, the scientific revolution, again, coming out of Christian values and Christian scientists. And freedom, we talk about emancipation and the abolition of the slave trade. And then progress. Why do we get the idea that tomorrow is meant to be better than today, and today we're meant to be reforming some of the evils that were back in the past? Again, that's a really profoundly Christian idea. And you add all those things together, and you've pretty much got the modern Western outlook. But all of those things are totally bonkers without Jesus. So yeah. It seems like we have a Western society that wants the fruits of Christianity, but not the roots. And it's really a call to Christians to recognize, you know what? Our ancient faith explains the modern world and explains it better than any secular thinker you can name. But also to those who think of themselves as secular and think of themselves as non-Christian and as not being believers, I want to point to them and say, you know what? You believe a whole heap of supernatural things. Like, if you think that human beings are equal, and if you think that a society should be judged according to how we treat the weakest and the least among us, if you believe in human rights and human equality and humanism and all these different things, you're already believing things that are not natural. They are not basic. They are not universal. Other societies have not thought this way at all. And the only reason we think these things is Jesus. And so it's a challenge to them to actually ground what they already believe in the Jesus story.
So that's Glenn Scrivener there. His book is called The Air We Breathe. And he's talking there about the whole idea of this kind of being normal, isn't he? Really? Look, I mean, it's not so strange. You just have to understand that the world is increasingly being run by the bad guys. So that's all for this week. Time to sign off. Thanks to our guests, mainly Johnny Vedmore, Nigel Day from Oxford CND. Thank you very much to them. We'll be back next week with a live programme. Hopefully Dave has not emigrated, and he'll be back to drive the show. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Telegram channel and via Not the BCFM Politics Show page. You can pop bits and bobs up on there, which includes the podcast, full-length interviews, story links and comment page. Subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. If you can afford it, it's free, yeah. If you can afford it, though, do donate. You can set up a small monthly sub, either by PayPal or straight into our actual bank account. at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling. My paperback's about deals between Churchill and the Nazis at the end of World War II. That's The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group. That costs £15. Free downloads as well, though. Also, my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination. The Siege of Heaven Readers, the title of that. They're both on eBay. You'll find the Siege of Heaven ebook with RT articles plus my most recent on John Dee and the Empire at www.bilderberg.org. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream and over Sunday breakfast at Camberley's RadioQUK.com. But unfortunately, Radio Q is winding down today. That's Friday, the 31st of January. Anyway, wish James all the best. I'm sure he'll pop up in some other form, not in the not too distant future. Do please make live recordings. We've been streaming live on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. Not, unfortunately, today. At DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let us know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the live Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. It's a war on God, but God's gonna win. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Lady Eleanor, oh. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do